They came from a world that was oppressive, ruled by kings and queens and popes and prelates and bishops and lords and barons, who just because they didn't like the way you look could chop you into quarters and throw you to the pigs if they wanted to, anytime they wanted to. And if you didn't believe the religion they wanted you to believe in, they'd burn you at the stake or torture you. In some way, make your life absolutely miserable. They came here to create a new world, free from all of that. But they knew that they could not be safe in the new world if the old world was the way that it was. How do you get rid of kings and queens and barons and lords and emperors and prelates and sultans and emirs? How do you do that? A new world order. From the beginning, that was the goal, ladies and gentlemen. That's the absolute truth. From the very beginning, that was the goal. What do you think new world means? What do you think it means? So they did something that was unheard of, never been done in the history of the world. They set the cattle free.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just on Jamaica Street here in Bristol in the UK. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, lockdown lunacy spreads as Israel announces its second wave lockdown to stop all Jewish festivals. And protests against the Prime Minister as well. And a UK government threatened to repeat original mistakes and turn sick elderly people out once more from hospitals into care homes, spreading the virus all over again. Almost unbelievable, isn't it? And meanwhile, we have two Trafalgar Square demonstrations taking place tomorrow and next Saturday in an attempt to convince MPs not to renew the Coronavirus Act legislation, which led to unprecedented disruption of society in a world that seems to have forgotten whether people are actually ill or not. Meanwhile, as everybody is distracted, it's a good time to bury Julian Assange. We get two reports on the case this week, one from the National Union of Journalists' Tim Dawson, another one from the renowned reporter and documentary maker from Australia, just like Julian is, John Pilger. Plus, on the international stage, the internet documentary Who's Behind Bill Gates? Plus, a roundup of David Livingston taking us from the scientists of the Royal Society behind Darwin to the origins of Salafism and fake Muslim schools of thought, which eventually became the terror groups we know so well today, the Salafists and people like that, that have been fighting in Syria. Quite an interesting journey from this Muslim scholar, the author of The Dying God, and also the author of Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea. Anyway, Martin, welcome. And I suppose we should start really by asking you again how your week's gone at school. It's the second week you've been back, isn't it?
Well, the second week I've been back. I mean, others have been back longer. We're just getting on with stuff. Everybody's supposed to stay in their little pods. We're not having any school dinners like we ever have to bring a packet.
So you are attached to, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it, the way that they've adopted this whole bubble idea that we had when I was stuck over in New Zealand. Mm. It was clear right from the start that was what was going to happen. A family, a household is a bubble, and yeah, you can mix fine within your own bubble, but you're not supposed to mix with others, which does rather make a mockery of this whole idea of a maximum of certain number of people being able to meet, because it might be more than that makes up one bubble.
Well, we've got more than that in Orca class, which I'm working in. And, of course, all of the families are therefore in that larger bubble. But I think the idea is that that class, we're not supposed to mix with people from other classes. And, the idea is to just create as many firewalls as possible for the virus.
Yes, well, whatever this virus is, it doesn't seem to be anywhere near as potent as the one that was in the normal flu season. But what's happened to the children? Do you think they're glad to be back?
By and large, yes. I mean, I think they want to see their friends, and they're not necessarily keen on doing maths every morning, some of them, but nevertheless, they want to be there to play with their friends, because obviously during lockdown they couldn't.
Well, what sort of effect do you think this has had overall the last 6 months, not going to school, on children? Positive or negative?
Well, I think for some kids it's actually been relatively easy, because they've got a very relatively supportive family environment. And for others, it's been much more challenging because their family environment isn't so supportive and then the school is a place of respite for them. Although many of those children did come in throughout the lockdown. Unfortunately, there's a kind of a certain section of children who are not recognised as being vulnerable because they haven't got a piece of paper that says they are. And those are probably the ones that have actually had the worst time, because the ones that have, where it's recognised that they're vulnerable, they've actually been in school all along. And the other ones, the others with a supportive family, they've been out of school, but it's okay. But there's certainly certain kids who've been out of school, who should have been in school, as vulnerable, but they weren't classified as vulnerable, so they're the ones who probably suffered the most.
So the ones who have been coming to school, are they, for example, children of essential workers?
There's two rules, isn't there? There's children of essential workers and also children who are classified as being vulnerable in one way or another. And that, of course, is actually an official classification of special needs. And some kids have got special needs, but as we know, they're not all classified. And that's where the problem lies, because if they're not classified, then you can't actually mobilise resources to support them.
Anyway, we'll be talking more about coronavirus. Obviously, it's sort of swamped us all. It certainly seems to have swamped coverage of Julian Assange's trial, but not on this show, a bit later on. But let's start by looking at this enormous announcement, which has got only little blips in the news this week, Martin, which is Hitachi, the Japanese high-tech firm, pulling out of Wilfer. Now, Wilfer is a nuclear power station up on Anglesey, which was has been stopped. It was been going for years. Then it was decommissioned. I think it's probably a more technical term than stopped. And now they're looking at recommissioning it, building a new reactor or recommissioning the old reactor. And Hitachi were involved in that. They've pulled out this week. So they're saying, no, we're not doing that. And it's the second Japanese company to pull out of British nuclear power plants in the last year or so. This has also led to a whole load of questions about just how viable this industry now is. Was it always likely to happen since it's such a high cost business, nuclear power?
I think so. I mean, basically the economics have never really stacked up, and the latest attempt to try and restart the nuclear industry, if you like, has been very much on the back of climate change concerns. But you can see the economics of energy have changed dramatically as a result of the economic crisis, lockdown, the collapse of the price of oil, and presumably Hitachi, which is a private company, will have made the decision to pull out because they can't see how they can make any money.
So let's have a listen now to a little extract from the BBC's 6 o'clock news bulletin on, I think it was Wednesday evening that I heard, and see what they had to say, because there's quite a lot in this. Have a close listen and you'll hear all sorts of, it's almost like they're explaining here that this is not just about Wilfer, it's a kind of house of cards.
It's understood that the collapse of a project to build a nuclear power station at Wilfer in Anglesey could accelerate approval for a new facility at Sizewell in Suffolk. Sources have expressed disappointment at the decision by the Japanese firm Hitachi to pull out of the Anglesey project, but insisted that the government remained fully committed to nuclear power as a way of decarbonising the UK's power supply by 2050. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
A decade ago, government ministers talked enthusiastically about a new nuclear age. Of 6 sites then identified, only 1 is under construction, 3 have been abandoned, and 2, Sizewell and Bradwell, are still waiting for the green light. One major sticking point over Sizewell has been the involvement of Chinese state-owned company CGN, which already owns a 33% stake in Hinkley Point C in Somerset, currently under construction by French firm EDF, which owns the other 2/3. CGN also agreed to take a 20% stake in Sizewell, on the understanding it would land the ultimate prize of building a reactor of its own design at Bradwell in Essex. But Chinese involvement in designing and running its own reactor on UK soil looked dead, according to both industry and government sources, given the deteriorating diplomatic relations after the government's decision to phase out Chinese firm Huawei's equipment from a new generation of telecoms networks. If a mobile network is considered too sensitive, it's hard to argue that a nuclear power station is not. If CGN are excluded, the government taking a direct stake in Sizewell is one of the options being considered, according to people familiar with the matter.
So that's the news bulletin, Martin. What do you make of what you've just heard? Because there's all sorts in there, isn't there? They keep using the word sources. which really means they're talking to government departments, I imagine. And the use of the word dead there to describe hopes that China was going to be involved. Now, China is not only involved at the Bradwell plant, which we're going to hear from now, that is over in Essex, a brand new site, which is 10 times the original old Magnox station plant. They have hit all sorts of problems in that Colchester Council is saying that they're going to oppose it in every way they can. Bradwell-on-Sea Parish Council, the local, and other local authorities have just turned down their planning permission for the groundworks that are needed to build that power station. I suppose the big question here is, if we're going to reject Huawei, are we also going to tell the Chinese to take a running jump when it comes to nuclear power?
Well, that was a suggestion made in the report that you just broadcast. And of course it is. I mean, if we're going to have a trade war with China to keep the Americans happy, then that's the sort of thing that's going to start happening, isn't it? Things that have been agreed for years are going to be thrown in the waste paper basket.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a confusing report because they're saying, oh, yes, Sizewell might accelerate, but Bradwell probably won't happen. So the questions are, of course, for Hinkley, what do you make here of our local power station, which is something like halfway through construction at the moment?
Well, EDF are obviously building it, and EDF, again, is another state-owned entity, just like the Chinese state-owned nuclear power company. And I suppose, ultimately, if the Tory government wants nuclear power in Britain, it's going to have to be nationalised nuclear power, isn't it? I mean, there's no other option.
OK, so anyway, let's have a listen to Johnny Aldridge now. I interviewed him about Bradwell, because this is really right on the cusp of being launched, this project over in Essex. So he had all sorts to say about whether he thought it was appropriate or not.
Within 15 miles, you've got Malden and Colchester. Within 50 miles, you've got London. And I don't kind of see half of London being evacuated very easily. In fact, I would put that in the impossible category. To me, it's the wrong place. It really is. Okay. However, the way that renewables work is that you do need some kind of storage. And the problem that you have with nuclear power stations is they work against renewables and they work against storage. Because what happens is, at the moment, when there's a lot of wind and there's a lot of sun, yeah, we get more electricity than we can use. But you have to keep the nuclear power stations running because you can't turn them off. And because you can't turn them off, they have to continue to run. So they have to turn off the wind turbines and the solar panels, which is crazy. I mean, there's lots of the politicians will tell you that this will tide us over. It will complement the renewables. Well, it's nonsense. It doesn't. It works against the renewables. You have to develop other systems. You have to develop a smart grid. You have to develop some kind of storage in order to make the renewables work correctly. We've got both onshore and offshore wind farms here. The onshore one is 8 turbines, so not very big. It's 9 turbines, I believe. The offshore one is part of the London Array, which is huge, and is one of the 3 largest in the world, I believe. I think that Britain has got 3 of the largest ones in the world, and the London Array, I believe, is that they keep adding more and more wind turbines, as you can imagine. And interestingly, I've tried to look up some of the arguments for having nuclear power. And they go back some years. I think it's 2008 was when the government white paper came out that was in favour of the nuclear power. But in those times, of course, there wasn't much in the way of wind turbine. They've got nothing really to compare it with other than coal, gas and oil. And of coal, gas and oil and nuclear was the best option, so they went with that. But the world has changed a lot since then. It really has. Yes, I mean, coal is nearly stopped completely. So it's not much good comparing things with coal anymore, like they did in those days. And the wind and solar has moved on so much. And of course, people are trying to develop battery storage and other kinds of storage. I mean, this typically the sorts of things that would happen is if you've got a smart grid and you knew when there was a lot of renewable energy available, you could then put water heating on. I mean, in individual homes as well as in large things that use a lot of hot water. But we don't know that, so we can't do that. It's why you need a smart grid.
So that's Johnny Aldridge there from Bradwell, speaking to me a few weeks ago. As it turns out, Martin, it's looking less and less likely that nuclear power station is going to be built by the Chinese and the French. And also, I mean, I love what he's talking about there is he's saying actually things are changing. The way of managing electricity, the idea that you can draw on a particular source when the rest of the demand is low, this can feed into the grid, not just in your home. And also that this whole idea that at times, say, for example, in the summer or late at night, it might be blowing a gale, but you can't use those wind generators because the nuclear power station is going to be ticking over on a low level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing about nuclear power is it only seems viable because of all the sunk costs you've put into it. And in China and France, the state has basically decided to have a big nuclear power program. And once the state has done that and created a big nuclear power industry, they've then got to try and recoup the investment they've made in it, which means that they then try and sell on the technology to other countries, which is why they do it, because it doesn't pay in France or in China. And the really reason it doesn't pay is as soon as you count in what are you going to do with the waste, which lasts for thousands of years, it's quite obvious that it's not economic.
So I spoke also to Dr. Chris Busby, who now lives out in the Baltic states. I think it's at Latvia or Lithuania or somewhere, after he was burgled by the police, would you believe? And they destroyed some of his experiments at his home. He is a long-time hero. Really, he's gone around and collected independently a lot of data on these nuclear power stations over the years and proven that that they have leukemia clusters around them. So the industry and the government denied this, but Chris went round and actually showed that there was cancer being caused both to animals and to people living around power stations. And even though it was officially completely denied, he proved it to be true. But Chris, I spoke to a few weeks ago about various things to do with the nuclear industry, and he had this to say about Hinkley.
All the activity that we're seeing near Bridgewater really going to just simply grind to a halt? We're going to be left with these half-built stations? That's what you're implying?
Yes, yes, yes. I think that's exactly what will happen. What will happen is that the bad guys who are running the show here are going to get the maximum amount of money out of it that they can and then go bankrupt. I mean, that's the way of the world now. What you do is you have some sort of building project. You see Boris Johnson is saying, oh, we're going to build, you know, we're going to build our way out of this desperate recession that's likely to come at us because we're spending so much money because nobody's doing anything because of the coronavirus. So we're going to build. What that means, that doesn't mean build. What that means is we're going to borrow money to build, okay? And so that's what people do. That's the name of the game. So you set up some bogus company like you know, Green Earth Cooperative. And then you get the planning people to, and this is already happening. He's opened up the planning all over the place. So you go to the planning people and you say, oh, we're going to build an enormous housing estate for all the poor people in the middle of that field over there. So you buy the field off the farmer for tuppence. And then you go to the banks and you say that this development is going to be worth 29 billion or million. And so the banks give you half of that. And then you put a few foundations in and then you go bankrupt and run off with the money. That's the way of the world nowadays. That's how money is made.
So that's Chris Busby, Martin, a pretty cynical view, but he's saying that actually a few people are going to make a load of money out of the whole Hinkley Power Station, but it will never finally be built.
Well, that's right, because in other words, it's not really a free market. It's underpinned by the government deciding that it wants to do it, which means basically that it's a win-win for those who are involved. Because they're not risking their own money in building it.
We're talking here really about a very weak government, aren't we? It's just subject to the nuclear lobby. The nuclear lobby gently twists its arm behind its back and it just signs on the dotted line without a by your leave.
Yeah, well, when you could say it's a weak government, but you could say it's a strong government pursuing the interests of the vested interests that control it. So it's not, you know.
Well, the government's not strong, otherwise surely it'd be kicking back and saying we're not spending any money on this.
But the thing is that they will use their powers to repress those who are opposing the policy. So in other words, if the private sector had to build nuclear power stations on their own dollar, and without support from the government, they wouldn't try it. But of course, once the government steps in, it's the same as with this test and trace system.
But the government hasn't stepped in with nuclear power, has it? It's always been there.
Well, no, the government created the nuclear power industry. There was no private sector nuclear power industry in the first place. And of course, at one stage, Margaret Thatcher thought of privatising the British nuclear power industry. And the City of London at that stage were really keen on privatisations. But I wrote a paper for the New Economics Foundation about all of this. As soon as they looked at the books, they said, we're not doing this. The only reason that there is nuclear power is literally because there was a nuclear weapons programme. And if you don't have a nuclear weapons programme, you might as well have a nuclear power programme. But otherwise,
haven't you got to have a nuclear power program?
There's lots of countries that haven't got one, Tony.
If you want to have a nuclear, what I'm saying is, if you're going to have a nuclear weapons program, you've got to have a nuclear power program.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The CANDU reactor, which was sold to the Indian government by the Canadians in the 1970s, is the basis of their nuclear weapons program. And the relationship between nuclear weapons program and nuclear power is intimate. But if you're going to have a nuclear weapons program, and some governments do, like us, then one of the ways they thought about this is, well, we'll have a nuclear power program as well, because if we're going to have nuclear weapons, we're going to have some waste, and we might as well use it for nuclear power.
Surely you can have a nuclear weapons program without a nuclear power program.
You can.
By buying plutonium and enriched uranium on the black market.
Or even on the open market.
Is there an open market in plutonium?
Well, no, what there is, the nuclear industry in Britain is entirely a product creation of the state, even though there are now private sector people making money out of it. And this is the way of crony capitalism that Britain operates on, which is that the government provides all the backup for the private sector to take the profits, and then if anything fails, the poor old taxpayer picks up the bill. And that is actually British policy going back to the 19th century, which is why we're in the massive cultural cul-de-sac that we've got ourselves into.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it, that Extinction Rebellion are basically pro-nuclear because of its low carbon footprint. Well, George Monbiot certainly is.
Yeah, but he's not Extinction Rebellion, he's George Monbiot.
Do you want to bet? He is Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah.
And in fact, here he is speaking I'm not sure if it's about a week ago or so, in central London at something called 55... Tufton Street, which is one of the big think tanks. I'm not quite sure which one it is. I'm not sure if he says it, which one it is. But here he is now talking about the role of think tanks, because these are the sort of organisations like these nuclear lobby groups we're thinking of that are so good at strong-arming government, Martin, isn't it?
Well, think tanks were invented in the US in the 60s and 70s because the corporate sector found that universities were too critical of what they were doing. So they created their own alternative to universities, the think tanks, which tell them what they want to hear.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist. And here he is speaking to an Extinction Rebellion rally at 55 Tufton Street.
I can't say how much this means to me. 20 years I've been trying to draw attention to what these people really are. In 20 years I feel I've been banging my head against a brick wall. And now I feel there are loads of us banging our heads against a brick wall. So that's got some kind of progress, isn't it? Now, when people call Dominic Cummings an evil genius, they're only half right. A lot of the so-called genius bit is done in places like this. I mean, that's not to say they aren't evil as well, because obviously they are, but a lot of the policy making, a lot of the ideas that Dominic Cummings is credited with, a lot of the really radical right policies that this government is implementing emerge from places like this. from 55 Tufton Street, from 57 Tufton Street, from Lord North Street, from Great Smith Street, from Great George Street. This nexus of organisations calling themselves think tanks, and which obediently the media also calls think tanks. But these are not think tanks, except in as much as they think about tanks. They are lobby groups. They are no different to lobby groups like Bell Pottinger or Burson Marsteller, who represent devious, destructive corporate and oligarchic interests, except for this: they do not reveal who funds them. This is a fundamental difference between them and people who come forward and say, we're representing the tobacco industry, we're representing the oil industry, we're representing the mining industry, and on their behalf, because they've paid us to do so, we're going to put their case across. These people are doing exactly the same, but not revealing on whose behalf they are doing it. It is a fundamental principle of democracy that we should know who is speaking. And what is speaking here? Hidden by opacity, hidden by this total failure of transparency and accountability, what is speaking here is the power of money. And the power of money is the greatest threat to democracy and the greatest threat to life on earth that we face. Now they have a name for the power of money, a euphemism for the power of money. They call it the market. And they talk about the market as if it's a law of nature, as if it's just something in the air, something in the water, something indefinable, which governs the way that we act. But what they call the market, this thing they say should effectively supplant democracy, this thing through which decisions should be made, is a forum within which wealth speaks, where there is $1, one vote, and those with the dollars are those who get to make the decisions. And the very purpose of the existence of these organizations is to translate the demands of extreme wealth into justifications that people will accept. It is to reframe, it is to refine, it is to hone the arguments until we end up believing the very opposite of where our interests lie. Until we end up believing that what is good for billionaires is good for everyone. Whereas what billionaires want is the extension of their own wealth and power at the expense of everyone and everything. And so we are here to call them out.
So that was George Monbiot speaking last week, actually not this week, at the same time as the blockade of the newspapers, of course, which is, I don't think the Guardian was blockaded, it was the other newspapers. So it's almost like a kind of newspaper journalist war. But he's making some very important points there about these lobby groups, Martin, isn't he? I mean, whatever, you know, you don't have to agree with George to understand that that this is an enormous hidden power influence. In fact, it's possibly, you could say in some ways, more powerful than the government itself. It can overwhelm governments, this enormous amount of money pushing specific lobbies.
The history of think tankery is that it really began in the 1960s in the US, as I said earlier. Because previously to that point, the universities had been the places that governments went to get policy and information and ideas to do things. But the universities gradually became, as far as the corporate sector was concerned, hostile territory. So think tanks were set up as a means of, creating an alternative to objective analysis of social problems. And he's quite right. The think tanks have, the think tanks surrounding this government in particular are very, very influential. And, you know, the Mount Pelerin Society, for example, founded in the 1940s, has been massively influential in economics departments. You know, what happens is the universities now have become captured by think tankery to a large extent. And, you know, the analysis that George Monbiot is making there of the way it works is pretty much spot on. You know, ordinary people don't get much of a say. There's been an academic study done in the US which shows that ordinary people's interests are virtually never represented in policy proposals that governments carry through. It's virtually 100% decided by oligarchic factions.
He stood outside a specific building there with a whole bunch of lobby groups in them, most of them anti-climate change lobbies put there by the oil industry, but there are also some lobby groups that George would probably agree with, that are lobbies that would be on his side of the argument. So isn't it a bit hypocritical to be sort of calling out one lot of lobbyists where you're not calling out another lot?
Well, I think the point he's making there is there's no transparency. I mean, we know that in Scandinavian elections, for example, people, the different political parties are supported by the public purse according to their level of support. Now, that's just political parties and elections. But the very least we should expect is, if a think tank is making recommendations to government, we should know who funds it. Who funds you? And of course, if we find out that you're being funded, for example, by the oil industry, then we can take with a pinch of salt what you're saying, and we may listen to it, but we know it's the oil industry speaking. What the think tanks do is pretend that they're giving an objective analysis, because they won't tell you where their funding comes from. And of course, they won't tell you because that's what their analysis is geared to, making the funders' objectives more palatable to the general public.
I think
public.
It was when I was away, wasn't it, that we did that review of Planet of the Humans. The film Planet of the Humans shows how there's quite a lot of investment funds. In fact, smart money, apparently, if they call it smart money, is moving away from traditional investment funds into these green investment funds. One of them is called 350.org. And these have moved into renewables in a big way. And I mean, I think it would probably be paraphrasing to say that Planet of the Humans film, to say fossil fuel assets are simply being replaced by investments in plastics, mining, oil and gas. So there's a sort of shift going on from one type of bad thing to another type of bad thing.
Well, I mean, genuine green activists would call that greenwash. Everybody pretends that they're green now. Everybody's green. But of course, which basically, we want to carry on doing what we've always done, which is exploiting the planet and people on the planet, and we don't want to change anything too much.
And the other thing
things must change, so everything must remain the same.
The other thing is these biomass energy. I mean, we're just talking about the nuclear industry, biomass energy, which effectively is now starting to chew into forests. The idea is a forest is growing for whatever, 100 years, and then at the end of the 100 years, you chop it down and feed it into a power station.
Yeah, I mean, there's a spectrum in the green movement. Of course there is. You've got what you might call your respectable greens, who are all in favour, for example, of nuclear power and biomass energy. And then you've got your more radical greens who are not in favour of any of those things. So you can't really say that there's a particular green view. But as I said earlier, the world, his wife and his dog are all green these days. And that includes nuclear, you know, the Pentagon claims to be the greenest military on Earth, you know, and all the rest of it. And it's all part of basically propaganda.
So one of the things that George wasn't talking about in that discussion was how the Rockefeller brothers have been going green, investing in Halliburton. This is the sort of thing that we're not hearing from a lot of the green lobby. They freed themselves, apparently, the Rockefeller brothers, of fossil fuels. The foundation remained invested in companies including oil services giant Halliburton. The Koch brothers run multinational petroleum transportation partnership Inter Pipeline Limited, and Caterpillar, whose bulldozers are familiar at scenes of deforestation and Palestinian home demolition. So I suppose what George is doing is he's picking his fight and he's saying, well, look, we're going to have to forget about things like the Rockefellers still being involved in military stuff, etc., and just concentrate on trying to stop these basically pro, or the people who are trying to win the argument that global warming is a scam?
Well, I think leaving aside global warming one way or the other, there is a basic problem that those with money determine the agenda. And you've got a spread of views amongst the billionaire class. George Soros, of course, has got more liberal views than the general run-of-the-mill billionaire, and that's why he comes in for such a lot of stick. But, of course, Sheldon Adelson is the biggest funder of US politics, and he is definitely a right-wing, pro-Zionist, anti-climate change, denying, you know, he's the one who chucks the most money at it. And he generally gets what he wants. And that's the way the US is run, and it's pretty much the way this country is run.
There's a pretty good article in the Grey Zone about a lot of this and some of the implications that came out of that film, The Planet of the Humans, which I think in a way was almost made for Extinction Rebellion activists, because it points out that the money is just shifting. It's not actually getting any more ethical at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, ultimately, the radicals believe, for example, that you're going to have radical land reform in developing countries. So it's not the problem of poverty and hunger in developing countries isn't because there isn't enough food. There is plenty of food. Poor people can't afford it. And, of course, in some parts of the world, like Kerala in southern India, poor people have been given access to land. In Brazil, they are immediately faced with repression, murder, and torture.
Okay,
and
so
that's the reality. And of course, we're not going to get a green revolution without a red revolution. The landowning classes have got to be dispossessed, peacefully or otherwise.
Does that mean people who own their own homes? The landowners?
Well, no. I'm talking about the big landowning classes in the developing countries.
Okay.
But of course, there's another issue about whether people, you know, in this country, the property market is a big scam for the upper middle class to make money from doing nothing.
Well, the middle class, not necessarily upper middle
class.
Well,
I'm just saying that the whole thing is a lot of free money for people. Yeah, you get your foot on the housing ladder at any level, and that is free money.
But everyone wants to do that, don't they? Hang on, Martin, because it's a basic human need to have somewhere to live, isn't it?
Yes, and the point is that in other countries there's a balance struck between the need or desire to own one's own home and the necessity to make sure everybody's somewhere decent to live. In Germany, large numbers of people, even wealthy people, do not own their own homes. They invest their money, if they've got any, in business, and that's another reason why Britain is so far behind German industry, because we don't invest in industry. We're good on conservatories, not so good on cars.
Okay, so it was let out last week. It's a fascinating article, and it's really a review of all the financial implications of the film Planet of the Humans by Michael Moore, which came out early this year. And the article is called Green Billionaires Behind Professional Activist Network That Led Suppression of Planet of the Humans Documentary. And we're talking here about these alternative so-called green investors that Mr. Monbiot would probably be patting on the back, having played quite an important role in suppressing this documentary and getting it taken off of YouTube, etc.
Well, I did read George Monbiot's critique of the documentary, and I think he had some fair points to make. But at the same time, what you've got to be aware of, what's it says in the Bob Marley song? Never let a politician grant you a favour. They will always want to control you forever. And this is, as you gradually move towards a rhetoric of inclusion and environmental concern, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So everybody, as I say, everybody claims to be green. The Pentagon claims that they've got green bombs. And of course they're green.
Organic petrol.
Organic petrol,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to Prime Minister's questions this week. And the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, was standing in for Keir Starmer this week. She took Boris on square, face-to-face on the lockdowns, and particularly, well, actually criticising the failure of testing. Now, there's a big argument going on as to whether we should be testing people who aren't ill. But anyway, Angela Rayner got stuck in.
Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, infections are rising. The testing system is collapsing. When you are the Prime Minister, you can't keep trying to blame other people for your own incompetence. We have the highest death toll in Europe, and we're on course for one of the worst recessions in the developed world. This winter, we are staring down the barrel of a second wave with no plan for the looming crisis. People can't say goodbye to their loved ones. Grandparents can't see their grandchildren, and frontline staff can't get the tests that they need. And what was the top priority for the COVID war cabinet this weekend? Restoring grouse shooting. I suppose, Mr. Speaker, it's good news for people like the Prime Minister's friend who paid for a luxury Christmas getaway to a Caribbean island and funded his leadership campaign and just so happens to own two grouse moor estates. So, Prime Minister, is this really your top priority?
Mr. Speaker, while the Labour opposition has been consistently carping from the sidelines throughout this crisis and raising, frankly, I think issues that are tangential, if not scare stories, about what is going on, we are getting on with delivering for the British public. We're not only ramping up, massively ramping up, and she, Mr. Speaker, she hasn't contested any of my statistics today about the extent to which this country is now testing more than any other European country. She hasn't disputed the massive acceleration in our programme. We are getting on. I'll answer the substance of her question. Thank you very much. We're getting on with delivering on the priorities of the British people. Getting us through this COVID crisis, delivering on making our country safer, by the way, bringing forward measures to stop the early release of dangerous sexual and violent offenders, which I hope that she will support, strengthening our union, Mr. Speaker, which in principle the front bench opposite should support, building more homes across this country, more affordable homes across this country, which he should support, in addition to recruiting more doctors, more nurses, and building more hospitals. Mr. Speaker, I don't think anybody is in any doubt that this government is facing some of the most difficult dilemmas that any modern government has had to face. But every day we are helping to solve them thanks to the massive common sense of the British people, who are getting on with delivering our programme, getting on with delivering our fight against coronavirus. And it's with the common sense, it's with the common sense of the British people that we will succeed, build back better and stronger than ever before.
Okay, so that's Angela Rayner, leader of the opposition, on Wednesday. How do you think she got on, Martin?
Well, I think she was, you know, she basically provoked Boris Johnson into a massive rant about it's completely different from what she was asking about. And
you could hear the backbenchers saying, why don't you answer the question in the background? And of course, he didn't.
No.
Ultimately.
No. I mean, of course, I mean, and he didn't answer the question about grouse moors, did he?
Nothing.
Why have grouse moors been allowed to have more than six people?
Well,
this is a rather strange sort of thing, isn't it?
Okay, well, it's
for them to decide that.
Okay, let's just take this from, obviously, you know, it's the same reason, surely, as to why you can have a football field or whatever with a lot of people, because there's a lot of air around, you know. It's not like it's an enclosed space. This is a big difference, surely. If you're looking at transmitting viruses, however they, you know, whether they are actually going to kill you or not, which doesn't seem to be even thought about, but a virus can be caught much more easily indoors or in a building than it can outside. The grouse moor, surely not.
But if I go to the park this weekend, I will not be allowed to be in a group of more than six people. If I go to a grouse moor, on the other hand, I can be in a group of more than six people. Why on a grouse moor? And of course, as she rightly pointed out, it's because the friend of Boris Johnson that paid for his trip to the Caribbean after he'd won the election just happens to own two grouse moors. And of course, he didn't answer the basic question because she's basically hit the bullseye. That's why he's decided to do it. And we were just talking about how people with money determine policy. There's an example of exactly how that happens.
I mean, if you're up on a grouse moor, surely people are spaced along anyway. You know, you've got your beaters. I mean, I'm not actually, I don't do shooting myself,
yes.
But you've got the beat. You have people spaced widely apart who do their separately shoot separately.
Well,
they're not all shooting from the same little unit.
If they're they're socially distanced, then there wouldn't be a question. They wouldn't need to have a rule about whether there's six or
maybe
six or
maybe
more.
Maybe it's in a little buggy that they take when they go up from, you know, wherever they pay their money.
Well, in actual fact, a lot of people who pay a lot of money to go to Grouse Moors want to go to Grouse Moors to meet the right people in the bunker. And of course,
it's a bit like golf, isn't it?
Yes,
but upper class.
Yes, more upper class than golf. And of course, Grouse Moors are actually, in fact, very environmentally problematic. They cause flooding and all sorts, you know. But that's another issue. But of course, they basically said, well, loads of people won't come to the Grouse Moor if they can't be in groups of more than six. And being a Tory government, and we did bung you a lot of money at the last election, surely you can give us a buy-in, best one. And of course, he did.
Extinction Rebellion have got a particularly nasty. They don't like Grouse Moors as it is. Before all this happened last year, they were up on the Grouse Moors protesting against them, so you can kind of see what's going to happen here.
Yes, well, they're a bit of a red rag to a grouse, aren't they?
Or to the grouse shooter.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is this could possibly be a bit dangerous if they're taking on a whole bunch of people with shotguns.
Well, maybe so, Tony, but Harold Wilson in the 1960s talked about Alex Douglas Hume, and he was basically he wasn't in the Parliament because he was up in Scotland on his Grouse Moor, and he said, well, this is the Grouse Moor way of running the country, because of course traditionally Liberal and Conservative cabinets used to go grouse shooting at the weekend where they used to do all their deals. And of course that's not really the way the Labour Party does stuff either then or now.
So you do, whereabouts does the Labour Party do it? Down the pub?
Traditionally, yeah.
Okay. Anyway,
not anymore.
It was a hinting there, wasn't there, a bit at the sole idea of national unity being under threat. So there was a very, very short answer for Boris on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the week in which the Prime Minister announced the government's new strategy on obesity, the eating disorder charity Beat experienced a 165% increase in number of people contacting their support services. I am pleased that the Prime Minister is focused on obesity, which is a very serious national.
Quite what's happened there, but none of those are the right Prime Minister's questions. Martin, I'll see if I can find it. Maybe you could say what you make of what's going on with this apparent. Well, what seems to be happening is the Scots and the Welsh are ganging up on the English and saying, well, we're not going to be cooperating with your internal market deal when it comes to the end of the year and the so-called deal with the EU.
Well, the Scots and the Welsh do have gripes with this internal market bill, but the real international problem is with the Irish, and we've seen this week, they're basically talking of withdrawing from the withdrawal agreement, which they've already signed with the EU and with the Irish. But of course, what's happened this week is it's been spelled out to them pretty clearly that if they do that, they won't be getting any kind of trade deal with the United States of America.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll be able to listen to this question about the internal market bill now.
Does my right honourable friend agree that this government's internal market bill will protect our United Kingdom, strengthen our mission to level up and back our negotiators?
Yes. Mr. Speaker, I could not have put it better myself.
And that actually was the only answer he gave. I couldn't have put it better myself. In fact, maybe his office did write it himself, because that was a very friendly question from a Conservative. In fact, we're hearing quite a lot of that. That's an American.
Mm. I thought that was that's not a Yorkshire accent, is it?
No, it's not. We're getting all these sort of foreign voices now coming into Parliament, but that's not what this is about.
She's elected.
Really,
she represents whoever she's
voted for. Oh yeah, well, she's been elected,
for.
You know. But who is she representing? The United States, or, you know, isn't it curious how so many more American voices have suddenly appeared on the scene as Brexit's coming along, supposedly, if it ever happens, it'd be a miracle or a disaster. But both on the BBC, we're hearing loads more American voices, but even in Parliament too. But what about the substantive issue here? What is going on with the Welsh and the Scots and the English falling out?
Well, it's the reason why we're hearing American voices this week is because the Americans have been dragged into this because of the Irish dimension to the problem. And of course, the Irish America is quite influential across the aisle in the United States. It's not just it's not just Democrats who got Irish ancestry. So that's the reason why they've been mouthing off this week. What's going to happen is the internal market bill means that government in Westminster will determine that things that were previously determined in Brussels will not be devolved to the devolved assemblies. They will be devolved only to Westminster, which means that Westminster can then override decisions that are made or decisions that they would like to make in the devolved assemblies. So it's more centralisation of power in London, which is what the Welsh, the Scots and the Irish have been complaining about for hundreds of years.
Right, so we're going to go and talk a bit about the COVID and all that stuff after we've had some music. But before we do that, Martin, final thing on Prime Minister's questions is this whole idea of people having eating disorders. There's a lot of people apparently getting fatter because of lockdown, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions as well on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the week in which the Prime Minister announced the government's new strategy on obesity, the eating disorder charity Beat experienced a 165% increase in number of people contacting their support services. I am pleased that the Prime Minister is focused on obesity, which is a very serious national health issue. But as the chair of the APPG on eating disorders, I have been contacted by many who suffer from an eating disorder, and they have approached me with concerns with certain aspects of his obesity strategy and the adverse effects it would have on them. Will the Prime Minister take these concerns seriously and commit to arrange a meeting between sufferers of an eating disorder, myself, and the relevant minister in his health team?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and I'm acutely conscious that there are no glib, easy answers in this area of public policy, and I happily undertake that the relevant minister should meet with the Honourable Lady as fast as possible to understand her concerns and the concerns of her constituents.
Right, so eating disorders. Now, one of the things that we've seen a lot big increase in is the number of suicides, Martin, but surely a lot of this eating disorder stuff is to do with basically comfort eating, where people feel that they feel a sense of anxiousness, that their future is unclear, there's basically an abusive relationship with the authorities, with the government, a hostile environment being created for people, whether they're asylum seekers or whether they're the poor, particularly under the Conservatives. And actually, overeating is a natural reaction to that sort of thing.
Well, as you know, Tony, as the Prime Minister rightly said, it's quite a complicated issue. The need, you know, the concerns that an individual might have about their eating, you can't really necessarily generalise from one person's problems. But of course, there is a major problem with poorer people overeating, as you say, comfort eating. And of course, what people often forget is that if you've got a microwave in your house, it's a lot quicker to just whack something in the microwave than cook properly if you've got to pay for electricity and gas. So, you know, there's a wide...
It's also time, isn't it?
Yes,
a lot of people don't have the time.
That's right. If you're working two jobs in a zero-hours contract, you haven't really got time to have a proper meal. I mean, in France, for example, historically, they had a very long lunch hour, and in Spain. And that actually is a very helpful way for people to eat properly and sensibly, because it's big, you know, it's built into the day that you're going to have a long and comfortable lunch hour, 2 hours to eat your lunch.
Okay, so being in a kind of financial cage, you know, imprisoned in an economic lifestyle that you can't necessarily, you know, so for example, your outgoings are more than your income, this sort of thing gets people tense. And as a way of just kind of getting through the day, sometimes people eat. But have you got any tips? I'm not saying, because you and I are a bit portly, but have you got any tips, you think, for, you know, what to eat and how to, you know, reduce your weight, how to not overeat?
I actually went to go to the nurse this week to to have a check-up. And yes, my weight has gone up over lockdown. And when we had Ian Henschel here last week, he definitely mentioned that my weight had gone up. So I'm getting the message. Okay. And I'm trying to cut down on the, you know, I mean, basically during lockdown, I was eating quite a lot because, you know, it fills the day up, doesn't it? So, you know,
it's not just a day it fills up, is it?
No, that's the problem.
So I would, just one thing I say is, you know, as a basic discipline, don't eat anything after 7 PM. It's quite a good little discipline if you can get into that. Mm. You know, have an early supper, an early dinner, and then don't eat and don't snack or whatever in the evenings. Also, of course, try and build exercise into your week. Like, say, for example, cycling, you know, that sort of thing. Not that I do it. But
well,
I'm just saying.
I mean, I don't think that the audience really needs our advice about healthy living, Tony.
Well, no, but I mean, maybe we do.
Maybe we do.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to be hearing a bit more about coronavirus, the lockdown lunacy, the mask madness, after we've heard a tune. Now, this tune is from, they call themselves, they're actually, I think, anonymous, but they call themselves Frankie Goes to Nowhere, and it's called COVID-19 The Musical.
No vax, refuse it. No vax, Snitches get rewards. We want to thank you for turning folks in and making sure we are all safe.
Okay, that's, I guess, Anthony Fauci.
7 billion people. People.
And Bill Gates finishing that song, which is, it's the what is it actually called? It's the COVID-19 the musical from Frankie Goes to Nowhere, obviously only out very recently. Martin, let's, before we get back into COVID, let's look at some of the big international developments this week, because the Julian Assange case has got to really be top of the list again, hasn't it? I think he apparently has come out in the court that he held back 15,000 documents to prevent harm to the US government, yet they're trying to extradite him and destroy him anyway.
Well, in actual fact, he was cooperating at that stage with The Guardian and The New York Times. And I believe in court this week, people have testified that he was very cautious about releasing documents which would, you know, point to individual people, but that The Guardian and The New York Times had no interest in redacting the documents. So far from him being slapdash, it was them that were slapdash. And, of course, they were perfectly happy to cooperate with him. And then they decided that he was, an evil person, and Luke Harding and others who cooperated with him have gone on to very successful careers as establishment lackeys.
It seems Julian Assange's main crime is that he didn't have a roof.
Yeah, that's what you could put it like that. Yeah, that's right. And, of course, you know, it's very interesting what's coming out in the court, but they're doing everything they can to prevent people finding out what's happening in the court. So, this court case should be held in public, and, you know, there's no reason, for example, why it shouldn't be televised, like the trial of O.J. Simpson. And then, of course, it would be on the news every night, but, of course, they're determined that he's not going to be given a fair hearing. And, of course, as we've said week after week, there is no basis in English common law, going back to Magna Carta, for him to be in prison at all.
So why is he being prosecuted? Is it simply that he's been given leaks? I mean, one does wonder what British journalists are doing, not covering this. Although I suppose, thinking about it, it's not the journalists, is it? It's the editors, it's the managers that have decided they don't want this covered.
Yes, and therefore, and also the people who own newspapers and television stations.
The moguls.
Who don't want this story out there. As we heard from Julian's father last week, there is some kind of stirring in the more liberal ends of the mainstream press that this is actually becoming a bit outrageous. But, of course, it is more than a bit outrageous. It is actually one of the worst oppressions that we've seen in this country for many years. And, of course, it's setting a precedent for the United States government to have extraterritorial power to silence people they don't want to speak. And, of course, they do that all the time with drones and missiles. Again, totally illegal. But what WikiLeaks has done is expose an awful lot of the absolutely criminal misbehaviour of the United States government.
OK, so let's have a listen now to, I mean, I'm talking about the journalists. It's not necessarily their fault that the newspapers haven't been printing much about this case and haven't reported on it properly, because the journalists, we journalists ourselves, we do not own the printing presses. We do not own the transmitters. We do not appoint the editors that decide what does and doesn't get covered, do we, Martin?
Well, no. And, there's also an attempt to claim that Julian Assange isn't a journalist. It's irrelevant whether he is or isn't a journalist. He should have freedom of speech under the US Constitution. But what the US is claiming is that only US citizens are entitled to freedom of speech. So if you're a non-US citizen, you've got no right to speak, according to them. And of course, they do go around killing people all the time, and they've got a massive gulag of secret prisons all over the world where people are being held with no legal basis whatsoever. Meanwhile, of course, they're pointing the finger at their political opponents in Russia and China. But who's got the worldwide gulag?
And Julian Assange really is the doyen of the internet. So he is the person who got himself into the position, you know, by choice or otherwise, who became the go-to person in the age of the internet when people couldn't get stuff published through mainstream press from newspapers. They could email Julian Assange, they could drop him a memory stick with a whole bunch of information on, and he would get it published. So this really is a kind of punishment killing in a way.
Well, killing, we're not there, we're not at killing.
He's not, well, he may.
Punishment,
you
know. Beating. Well, I mean, you will find that all, lots of mainstream media outlets have now got secret drop boxes. But it was WikiLeaks that pioneered that years ago.
Well, the interesting thing is you could take your secret information to many of those and get nowhere with it. You knew with Assange, he'd take one look at it, and if it was of public interest, he would publish it.
That's right. And, but even mainstream, news organizations have copied the techniques of WikiLeaks, even if they ultimately decide not to publish stuff that their owners don't want published.
It all depends on the owner's loyalty, isn't it? They often will get stuff and they will then run it past lawyers. Now, at that point, the lawyers will look at it and they'll maybe even be paid by some of the powerful interests that might be damaged by that information to lean on the organisation not to publish it, to find legal reasons why something shouldn't be published. This is why I find that, you know, you've got to be very careful as an editor to, if you're taking a bit of legal advice, that legal advice has not been tainted with, you know, a few brown envelopes given to the lawyer by the people who the information is criticising.
Well, ultimately, in a freedom of speech setup, people can say whatever they like and not say whatever they like.
I mean, this is the great thing about the internet, is you could do it. Anybody could do it.
Yes,
in the age of the
but
internet.
Yes, but at the same time, at the beginning of the internet, it was, as you say, a new phenomenon. But now, of course, there are all kinds of very sophisticated strategies for controlling internet perceptions. And people get paid quite a lot of money by, you know, wealthy individuals and organizations to spin the internet. So the Integrity Initiative, for example, the Institute for Statecraft are funded by the British government, like Brigade 77. So they're using our taxes, and they're out there basically spinning and disinformation on the internet against the political opponents of the regime. And of course, in the case of Integrity Initiative, spreading misinformation about Jeremy Corbyn at taxpayer expense.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to from the National Union of Journalists. I think I made my point about this not being journalists that are doing this. It's owners and editors doing it. And then followed by Tim Dawson from the NUJ, we have a longer talk by John Pilger. And this was given outside the Old Bailey last week.
In February, we spent a week listening to complex and convoluted legal arguments about the nature of this extradition, but really what stands at its core is very simple indeed. Do we have a right to know? Yes. Do we have a right to know when murder is committed in our name? Do we have a right to know when countries are secretly bombed with drones in our name? Do we have a right to know when institutional policies are put in place to torture prisoners? I say that we do, and that if Assange is extradited, that freedom will be fatally damaged.
Yeah!
If this extradition goes ahead, if Assange is tried in a medieval legal system, it will chill journalists and free expression the world over. Make no mistake about that. That's why our call should be clear and unequivocal. End these proceedings now, free Julian Assange, and defend free expression wherever it's threatened.
Yeah!
Julian believes that journalists are the agents of people, not power. That we, the people, have the right to know about the darkest secrets of those who claim to act in our name. If the powerful lie to us, we have the right to know. If they say one thing in private and the opposite in public, we have the right to know. If they conspire against us, as Blair did over Iraq, then pretend to be Democrats, we have the right to know. If this morality of purpose, it's this morality of purpose that so threatens the collusion of powers that want to plunge much of the world into war and now wants to bury Julian alive, in Trump's fascist America. In 2008, a top-secret U.S. State Department report described in detail how the United States would combat this new moral threat. A secretly directed personal smear campaign against Julian Assange would lead to, and I quote, exposure and criminal prosecution. The aim was to silence and criminalize WikiLeaks and its editor. Page after page revealed a war on a single human being and on the very principle of freedom of speech and freedom of thought and democracy. The imperial shock troops will be those who call themselves journalists. The big hitters of the so-called mainstream, especially the liberals who mark the perimeters of dissent.
Very good.
And that's what happened. I've been a reporter for more than 50 years, and I've never known a smear campaign like this one. The fabricated character assassination of a man who refused to join the club, who believed journalism was a service to the public, never to those above. Julian shamed his persecutors. He produced scoop after scoop. He exposed the fraudulence of wars promoted by the media and the homicidal nature of those wars, the corruption of dictators, the evils of Guantanamo. He forced us in the West to look in the mirror. He exposed the official truth-tellers in the media, so-called, as collaborators, those I would call Vichy journalists. None of these imposters believed Julian when he warned that his life was in danger, that Sweden was a setup, and he was right, and he was repeatedly right. The extradition hearing here this week is the final act of the campaign to bury Julian Assange. It's not due process, it's due revenge. The American indictment is clearly rigged, a demonstrable sham. So far, the hearings have been reminiscent of their Stalinist equivalents during the Cold War. Today, the land that gave us the Magna Carta is distinguished by the abandonment of its own sovereignty in allowing a malign foreign power to manipulate justice, and by the vicious psychological torture of Julian. A form of torture, as Niels Melzer, the UN expert, has pointed out, that was refined by the Nazis because it was more effective in breaking its victims. Every time I've visited Julian in Belmarsh prison, I've seen the effects of this torture. When I last saw him, he'd lost more than 10 kilos in weight. Incredibly, his wicked sense of humor was still intact. As for Julian's homeland, Australia, Australia has displayed only a cringing cowardice as it has secretly colluded with a lawless power against its own citizen who ought to be celebrated as a national hero. It's said that whatever happens to Julian in the coming weeks will diminish freedom of the press. But which press? The Guardian, the BBC, the New York Times, the Jeff Bezos Washington Post? No, the journalists in these organizations can breathe freely. The Judases on The Guardian, who flirted with Julian, exploited his landmark work, made their pile, then betrayed him, have nothing whatsoever to fear. They are safe because they are needed. Freedom of the press now rests with the honourable few, the exceptions, the dissidents on the internet who belong to no club, who are neither rich nor laden with Pulitzer Prizes, but produce fine, disobedient, moral journalism, those like Julian Assange. Meanwhile, it's our responsibility to stand by a true journalist whose sheer courage ought to be inspiration to all of us who believe that freedom is still a possibility. I salute him. Thank you.
Okay, so that's John Pilger there speaking last week at the Julian Assange's extradition hearing, Martin. All sorts of points he teases out there. He calls The Guardian's Vichy journalists collaborators for taking scoop after scoop from Julian and now stabbing him in the back.
Yeah, well, I think that's particularly appalling about this situation. Both the New York Times and The Guardian were quite happy to basically get scoops from WikiLeaks, and then they decided, and journalists like Luke Harding have basically made their careers on the back of it, and now they don't want to know Julian Assange at all.
There was that bizarre symbolic act, wasn't there, where Alan Rushbridger, who was the Guardian editor at the time, took a sledgehammer and was forced legally to smash up a hard drive on a piece of concrete.
Yeah.
And it was almost that from that moment on that The Guardian kind of gave up its fight to actually tell us the truth about what WikiLeaks the leaks that WikiLeaks was getting out for us. And they just turned their back on him, really.
Yes, and I think that what John Pilger said there, the liberal journalists police the boundary of dissent. So people read The Guardian. I mean, plenty of people in the country think The Guardian's some kind of raving pinko rag. Well, in actual fact, it's a voice for the British intelligence services in its foreign coverage. And, of course, they did work with Assange, and now they've decided that he's non-new and he's in prison and they're in the Groucho
Club. The key thing here is, effectively, and he's making a terrific accusation there about Britain effectively abandoning its sovereignty. We're saying, actually, now we're admitting we're ruled by the United States.
Well, I mean, this is pretty clear. I mean, the United States is pushing for its own internal laws to override other people's laws. At the same time as they won't sign up to the International Criminal Court, and they're now putting sanctions on the International Criminal Court, the one that sent down Milosevic or attempted to send down Milosevic and Mladic and so on, and they're not signatories to the law of the sea. But nevertheless, they want to fight with the Chinese in the South China Sea. The Chinese have signed the law of the sea. The US hasn't signed it. But they're the ones with the ships saying, you've got to do as we say. And of course, the other thing that's coming out from this case is that the US is trying to argue that the US Constitution, which allows American citizens freedom of speech, only applies to American citizens. It doesn't apply to other people. So Julian Assange is in the catch-22 situation of, because he's not an American citizen, he's not entitled to freedom of speech. But because he's not, even though he's not an American citizen, he can be charged with treason to the United States, even though he's an Australian citizen resident in the UK. And this, of course, basically is not legal in any way, shape or form, but the British legal system, Belmarsh Prison, the Old Bailey, is going along with this. And of course, this has happened in the past in Britain. The idea of Britain as this great law-abiding place is rubbish. I mean, you know, 250,000 plus people died in the concentration camps in Kenya, run by the British, all illegal. Probably more people in that period killed in Kenya than were killed in the Soviet Union. But nobody's ever been punished. Nobody ever will be punished.
2 hours ago, Martin.
That's who we are.
Today, Al Jazeera, another media outlet, Press Association, Bloomberg, saying that Donald Trump offered Assange a pardon in return for giving the source of hacked emails.
Well,
I imagine those are the emails to do with the Democratic National Convention in the last presidential
election. In actual fact, Assange has said he's prepared to testify in the US that WikiLeaks did not get the material about the fixing of the primaries at the last presidential election in the US.
That's right, it says
from
hacked.
Russia.
Everywhere it says hacked, hacked, hacked. It says hacked emails, but maybe these emails were copied and pasted and handed to WikiLeaks.
They were given to Craig Murray by a so far unnamed informant, but the obvious person that it might have been was Seth Rich, who was a young man who was...
Isn't it easier for Julian Assange just to say, hang on, it was Seth Rich and Craig Murray, and then he can get a pardon from Trump?
No. What Julian Assange has done in the relation to Seth Rich, which is quite important, is WikiLeaks did put up $20,000 as a reward for anybody who gave information leading to the conviction of the people who murdered Seth Rich, because he was murdered in a so-called robbery where the robbers didn't take his mobile phone or his wallet full of money. And in actual fact, the suspicion is that he was murdered because he was the source of the leaked emails which went to WikiLeaks, and has nothing to do with the Russians whatsoever. And of course, WikiLeaks basically have said that all along. And at one stage, when Trump was under attack from the Democrats about being controlled by Russia, etc., and that the Russians, he basically was quite keen that Assange should come to the US and testify. But now, of course, Trump, basically being a puppet of the deep state, has decided that he says he's never heard of WikiLeaks, and he doesn't know anything about Julian Assange, even though previously he was going on about how Assange was definitely going to come up with the goods to prove that he wasn't working with the Russians. Basically, Assange publishes stuff which is true, and let the chips fall where they may. If it helps Trump, if it doesn't help Trump, it doesn't help Trump. The point is, the DNC National Committee rigged the primary against Bernie Sanders. And of course, Bernie Sanders should have been the candidate, and he wasn't. And of course, if you don't have the right candidates in the election basically isn't democratic. So the modern Russian elections for the president are far more democratic than what we see in the United States of America. But of course, the United States of America and Britain, where we invented democracy, inverted commas, we're by definition democratic. But, I mean, everybody else is undemocratic by comparison.
Isn't this rather rubbish. Cheeky of Trump to say, if you tell me where you got those emails, I'll give you a pardon? Because that's going to benefit him in the presidential election.
Well, in actual fact, I don't think Trump said this.
It's been said through U.S. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, Republican, offer of a pardon to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in what they call a win-win deal that would benefit the U.S. President Donald Trump and Julian Assange.
Yeah, but I think that, if Trump does that, I shall be extremely surprised. He could do it. In any case, never mind.
They said it was done, and this was an offer that was made, and Julian turned it down.
Well, I can see why Julian would turn it down, because in actual fact, he doesn't need a pardon because he hasn't committed a crime. You can only pardon people if they've committed a crime. And if you accept a pardon, you accept that you've done something wrong. And he doesn't accept that he's done something wrong because he hasn't. And therefore, he's not entitled to a pardon because he don't need one.
Fair enough. Meanwhile, over in Australia, we've got some very strict measures to do with lockdowns going on. Fewer rights than North Korea, says the Daily Mail. Chilling reality of Melbourne under Dan Andrews, stage 4 lockdown. Melbournians are living under stricter lockdown rules than China or North Korea had. Victoria capital would have been locked up for 6 months by October 2020, despite Victoria having an Australia First Charter of Human Rights. They've all been torn up. Swinburne University Law School Dean Professor Mirko Bagarix explains why in this article, also argues how part of the Victoria government's response is illegal. So you've got lawyers and professors saying what the government there is doing, effectively in Melbourne, is despotic.
Well, I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion, and the Daily Mail's definitely got a view on this, as we know.
Oh, this isn't the Daily Mail, Martin. This is the Swinburne University Law School Dean, Professor Mirko Bagarić. So he's actually from there.
Yeah.
And he's saying that... So you don't think it's strict enough in Australia?
Various people have got different views about this in Australia and elsewhere.
So you think it's okay to tear up your human rights in order for a virus that's gone and isn't killing anyone?
No, Tony... I'm not going to be drawn into a silly argument about this.
Well, it's not silly, is it? Because a lot of people have lost their civil rights.
Yes, and a lot of people have died. And
they're not dying now, though, are they?
Well, it depends where you are.
No, they're not. They're not. Not in Australia. Not here.
All right.
The death figures are about around for a week were something like 50, and these were all people with COVID-19, not a single one of them of COVID-19. So they've all got other pre-existing conditions. If you look at the graph, as we've said many times on this program, there's lots of cases, but these people are not ill.
All right, Tony, I'm not going to enter it. I basically follow this as much as you do. Different countries have adopted different strategies. All countries claim to be behaving according to their existing laws. Maybe not. That's not true.
So you don't
in certain
think
cases.
The Australian governors have overstretched their powers here and are acting irrationally?
I do not know. I do not. I'm not an expert in Australian law, Tony.
What about in medical?
I'm not an expert in medical matters.
You would be
either.
Happy to stay at home for 6 months, even though there's hardly any death.
I'm basically listening to what I'm being told by various people, and as you know, there are conflicting views about both the virus and the legality of actions that have been taken. I've got my own views about it, which are not to do with biological warfare and the financial services sector.
What the Professor Bagaric has been saying is that the saturation media coverage of the pandemic has diminished the capacity of key government officials to engage in rational thinking, he says, and instead their decisions are being driven by their feelings and a fanatical desire to flatten a curve of cases, not a curve of deaths or illness, but of positive tests. And this is almost impossible because they're doing more tests all the time, which is meaning that the number of positive tests they're finding, even though people aren't ill, is growing. Anyway, so the curves are based not on your actual medical condition, they're just based on test results now.
Yep. And of course, as you know, there is no lockdown in China where this began, because they had a local lockdown in Wuhan. They tested everybody in the city, 10 million people, and now everybody in China is back to work and the schools are functioning normally.
Before we get away from talking about journalism, I think just as one particular, having John Pilger, etc., there, is the BBC this week have abolishing radio reporters, which I found absolutely scandalous, shocking. There will be no more radio reporters. This is a job I used to do at the BBC. They're all going to be some sort of like multimedia person that doesn't just do reports for the radio, they do reports for absolutely everything. The radio voices, so says The Guardian, have described history. Critics fear, though, an end of an era because of plans to make audio journalists, radio journalists, abolished.
Yeah, well, we've also heard, as you know, from people who used to be involved in local BBC in the West, that the BBC is cutting back on journalists full stop. There aren't going to be local journalists, radio or otherwise. And this is all to do with the fact that defunding of the BBC by the Conservative government, they've put in their hitman Leslie to run it, and it's pretty clear that they want the BBC to be more like the Daily Telegraph.
A lot of people have criticised the BBC, Martin, but the thing is, without it, it's a sort of a benchmark that other newspapers and, you know, for example, Sky, people like that, if there was no BBC, of course, Sky might change, mightn't it? Because it doesn't have BBC as its competition anymore.
Well, that's right. I mean, the purpose why countries have national broadcasters like Polsat in Poland or...
Well, Sky, by the way, is American-owned.
Well, indeed.
Comcast.
So why do countries have their own public broadcasters? It's because they want to create at least some part of the media where there is going to be, minority voices are going to be heard, and there's going to be some balance in the presentation. But, of course, if you have a private sector show with no public broadcasters, then it's simply the person with the most money who gets the loudest voice. And you've got media moguls like Maldonado in Brazil, Berlusconi in Italy, who at one stage was the country's richest man. He owned most of the media, and at the same time he was the prime minister. And people don't realise that that is actually an abuse of power. I don't know how you can explain it.
It's interesting to me that what's going on in Australia seems to be being ruled by media. So whatever's the biggest scandal in the media that day, that's what the politicians seem to be jumping on.
Well, what you've got in Australia is,
of course,
the baleful influence of Rupert Murdoch over many years, as John Pilger will tell you.
Well, yes, you can say that, but here is a voice on Sky TV Australia. Is a guy called Alan Jones. So we've been doing what Pilger, Assange, the Victoria lockdown, and now, so we're looking a lot at Australia here. This is an introduction to a program by Alan Jones just last week, literally on Sky TV Australia. And this is what Alan Jones had to say. He's not happy with the government and with the extent of the lockdowns and the destruction of civil rights and civil liberties right across Australia.
We've had leaders here in the country who've done nothing but ignite fear and alarmism and anxiety. Still not one has sought to comfort innocent and trusting Australians with the news that 99% of the cases are mild and only 1% are serious or critical. In fact, as I speak to you today, in the last 24 hours, no new cases in the ACT, 5 in New South Wales, none in the Northern Territory, none in Queensland, 1 in South Australia, none in Tasmania, none in WA. Victoria excluded, there are 11 people in hospital and 7 in intensive care. And the economy is being smashed. Now the panic. Try to tell us that, oh, you'll have a vaccine by mid-2021. Live in hope. When the medicine we've been dished out is nothing but fear, and people have had their freedoms crushed, their very spirits destroyed, lockdowns imposed with no evidence presented that they work, blunder on lecturing people. And instead of reading out these meaningless statistics every day to frighten everybody, why not tell the public that worldwide there are 700,000 deaths from coronavirus, but there are 60 million deaths in the world every year. 60 million. Why do we have to have this daily recitation of cases? Is there any other disease for which this happens? Cancer? So far this year, there have been 5.1 million deaths from cancer. We don't get daily updates. Why not tell the Australians that 440 people die in Australia every day? In 6 months, we've had 420 deaths from coronavirus. But if you're going to throw numbers at us, tell us each day how many Australians have been made jobless by your government's decisions. How many businesses have been forced into bankruptcy? How many mortgages can't be paid? How many people are homeless? What's the increase in domestic violence and marriage breakdowns and suicide? And if you're keen on figures, all you pseudo-leaders, give us all the figures and answer one question. How much do you think we're prepared to pay for all of this? We're up to $360 billion, and that doesn't include the cost of 750,000 people out of work, business being buried, people taking their lives. When is enough enough? When does this rubbish leadership end? Get out of our lives. We can manage our own well-being. Government's job is to look after those who can't look after themselves. The elderly should have first call on those services. Instead, governments drunk with power are trying to manage all our lives, and they failed. And it's time we told them this is nothing more than a political stunt to justify taking away our liberties and our freedoms, locking the joint down, making sure we obey, oh, and if you don't, you'll cop the punishment. Grab power over everybody, which they most probably don't intend to surrender.
So that's Alan Jones on the Sky TV Australia speaking there, Martin. Pretty strong saying things like the 99% of these people are not ill. What are they doing? He's saying they're drunk with power. Effectively, they're just doing whatever it is that the media and the lobby groups, we heard about them from George Monbiot earlier on, are telling the government to do. They're taking no notice whatsoever of human rights or the actual needs of ordinary people.
Well, as you know, Sky News Australia is controlled by Murdoch. Those views that we just heard are pretty close to his views. And of course, the Murdoch press in Australia was pushing the idea that it was definitely a biological weapon that had leaked from the Wuhan laboratory, although MI5 and MI6 here poo-pooed that. Now, it may very well be a biological weapon, but I don't think it was leaked from the laboratory.
Well, he's not talking about that.
No, he's not talking
about
that
at all.
No,
he's not talking about that at all.
No, he's not. He's talking about liberty and freedom.
He's talking about the complete mismatch between what is actually going on the ground medically and the massive lockdowns that are taking place. It almost seems as if it's designed to smash the economy and to destroy Australians' will to live.
It's designed to smash the economy because the financial services sector started collapsing in September last year in the United States.
So they're committing suicide, are they, or they're masochists?
No, what they're doing is is probably, you know my views on this, I think it was probably a biological weapons attack by the deep state in the US on the Chinese Communist Party regime.
It's finished now. Why are they still hurting themselves?
Well,
why are they still stabbing themselves in the chest?
Because they need a reasonable excuse across the world, not just in Australia, to carry on bailing out the banks, which is what they've been doing ever since this crisis began.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of these coronavirus acts that have been passed around the world, particularly here in the UK, are coming up for renewal very soon at the end of September. So the idea may be simply to make the terror real, the 7/7 attacks that made the terror real. We've got to make COVID real by having all these figures up on the TV every day, panic measures being taken, local lockdowns, all that sort of thing, in order to keep the panic going. It certainly does seem as if there's a tremendous amount of fear mongering.
Well, as you say, Tony, there are different views about this. The Chinese Communist Party took it seriously from the get-go, and as I said earlier, there's no lockdown in China. Their armed forces are absolutely ready to go for fighting the China,
really
South China Sea.
You're not addressing this question at all, are you, of the lack of people actually dying or being ill, and yet the lockdown's still being imposed?
Well, in India and Brazil...
No, we're not talking about India and Brazil. We're talking about Australia, and we're talking about Britain.
There's no lockdown going on in New Zealand either, is there? Because they haven't got any COVID, because they jumped on top of it straight away. What happened in Australia, in Victoria, is they let it run. In the United States of America, they let it run.
We're talking about now, Martin.
Yes.
So you're just refusing to address this question. I'm going to ask you to address it again, mm-hmm. which is large numbers of cases, very low numbers of anybody actually ill, and yet the lockdowns continue.
Well, that's because we don't actually know very much about what this virus is. We do suspect that it's got SARS in it, and it's got some AIDS things in it, which suggests to me that it's a biological warfare agent designed to wreck the economy. It was originally designed to wreck the Chinese economy, but it failed.
It's not a warfare agent at the moment if it's not killing people, is it?
It is. It has been in the past.
We had a very big spike in the months of March, April, May, down in June. Now it's all finished. Why is the lockdown carrying on in Australia? Just answer the question.
Listen, the decision in the Victoria to carry on the lockdown is a decision for the local authorities in Victoria, isn't it?
So the people don't have any say in it?
Well, they elect the local authorities. And if they're not happy with what they've done, they will get a chance to elect to vote them out.
Well, maybe
there's about to be an election in New Zealand in about a month's time.
Well, in Australia, in Victoria, they can't get rid of them at the moment, can they?
Well, that's true of the whole world. And, of course, you can't vote out the Chinese Communist Party either. They've had a pretty good COVID war.
Are you saying
that the whole of China, when probably a quarter of humanity, is COVID-free?
Are you saying that there isn't censorship of doctors' expert opinion then, and there isn't a bias in the press saying that the, talking up the effects of COVID-19?
The purpose of having the
answer the question. Is there or isn't there?
There is bias in the press of all kinds, Tony. I want to come back to what I consider the most important things about this thing, which is it's basically a biological warfare attack on China, which has been allowed to flow back over the United States and Australia so that they've got an excuse to bail the banks out.
Why is the West then being so masochistic in locking itself down?
Because they need to have the COVID crisis, whether it's real or not, leaving that aside. I think there is an element of reality here. It may well be, Tony, that you're proved right in January and February, and in actual fact, there will be no second spike in deaths in this country. But I tell you now, the Tory government are terrified. If there is a spike in deaths in January and February, they know that all the elderly voters that vote for them are going to have their guts for garters, which is why we're going to have serious lockdown. This is why the government here is pushing back to bring back lockdown. And of course, if they brought in a lockdown from the get-go, like the Chinese and North Koreans and the New Zealanders, we would have completely cleared the virus by now and everybody could be back to work. Because they didn't do that, we've got no good choices.
Yes, we have. We could just open everything up again because the virus is gone and the pandemic finished in June.
All right, you're saying that now on this show, Tony.
There's a lot of other doctors saying it.
We're
going to hear from those doctors now. Well, I'm just passing on what these doctors are saying.
All right, well,
let's have a listen
maybe
to these.
You're right. You're right. We will see what happens in January
Martin,
and February,
you've already
Tony.
Said that. Let's have a listen now to some German doctors. They're part of a group called the Association of Doctors of Enlightenment.
My name is Heike Schöning. I'm a medical doctor from Hamburg, Germany, and I'm one of the co-founders of Doctors of Enlightenment, in German Ärzte für Aufklärung. This organization of medical doctors represents more than 1,000 international doctors worldwide. So, what we say together is that this story with COVID-19 is not on any scientific basis. It's just a lie. So we need to say that this is just something to turn around the economy. So in the center is not any health problem. So believe me, coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 is not the problem. The real problem is the economy. So this is a good story for all people in the world, for all people who are now forced to wear masks. So these masks are bad for health. We have scientific studies that show this. We already presented all scientific facts that showed these masks are not good for the people. They are not protecting from any virus. It's just ridiculous. What is much more serious, of course, is the abuse of our civil rights. And these civil rights are very important for health as well, because it gives you a better feeling, better for your immune system. In Melbourne, Australia, we see now, from the beginning of August 2020, a lockdown stage 4. What does this mean? And who implemented this? This lockdown stage 4 in Melbourne, Australia means that they were locked down like in martial law from 8 o'clock in the evening up to the dawn, up to 5 o'clock in the morning. All shops are closed over there, only very few for living. The children, and especially the children, are suffering. The children are not allowed to go to school. We have the same situation here, partly in Germany, and our children are suffering. And this is not based on any scientific facts. I need to emphasize this again. So we need to ask ourselves, cui bono? Who profits out of this? And we see that these are highly criminals, these are oligarchs. Oligarchs are not only in Russia, they are in the United States and in other countries as well. They own Google Vaccinator as well, and the company Emergent Biosolutions, former name Bioport. We have this story that we have a deadly virus or bacteria. We had this story before. It was the same pattern. And I just would like to remind you just shortly. In 2001, we have this anthrax attack with this anthrax panic. And it's very similar to the corona panic as well. And guess what? The same people behind the same company, Emergent Biosolution now, they made the big money out of this. Yeah. And today, in Germany, the Minister of Health bought 300 million doses of vaccines against COVID-19 from the company AstraZeneca. But guess who's producing this? It's an American company, and same again, it's Emergent Biosolutions, yeah? Former name Bioport. So we have a criminal line, and we need to investigate this, and we need to charge these organized crime. It's nothing else. We have no health problem. All data show this. We have a problem with organized crime, and in the center is the economy. Thank you very much indeed.
I just received the message that on the Siegessäule there is a lot of violence by the police, so I have to check this. I pass the word to Bodo, and I come back when we fix this.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. I'm very honored to be on the side of Mr. Kennedy in this fight against the crime of the century. This is the crime of the century. I want to remember you. It's the fourth time they try this. It was anthrax, it was the bird flu, it was the pig flu, and now it's COVID-19. They tried the same thing, the same phrases, the same thing with the vaccination as the solution for the problems in the world. And the only thing behind it, everyone knows right now, right here on the channels, we have to tell the truth. There is no danger for the people. The thing is, the people believe in this mask because they think they can get back control, and they are frightened to death. And this is the way also Goebbels said, you don't need fascism or socialism. The only thing you need to control the public is fear. But right now we are very, very much people who have recognized that there is a problem. We are censored. My name is Bodo Schiffmann. I'm just an ORL doctor, and I make YouTube videos. And I started making YouTube videos and got a lot of information. The very startling thing on this is that they are not lying. You can read these scripts for this pandemic on the side of the Bundestag. You can read it on the World Health Organization, the scenario 201, and how to treat the COVID-19 disease and something like this. You find a totally script like for a movie, and they are not lying about the numbers. You can get the numbers from the Robert Koch Institute or wherever you like to. The numbers are correct, but the people, they're not listening. The only thing they are listening to is the mainstream media. The dark side of the mainstream media, where the alternative facts, as Donald Trump would say. So when you have a look at them, you won't find them. Right now in the press, there is no word about this friendly revolution thing in the streets, and nobody talks about this. We are right now, and it's hard to say this, in a totalism, fascistoid state in Germany. They're controlling the media, they censor our meaning, they're not hearing the opposite side. The thing why I do this is because I have two childs, one in the age of 9 years, one is 14. I don't want them to grow up like this, and they are not wearing masks, I am not wearing masks too. And I strongly believe in God, and I'm a Christ, and I think it's a chance for all people, for all religions, to get together across borders, and also the Muslim people or the Jewish people and everyone. Now we are all in the same boat, and we all have to fight against this, I think, diabolic side. Thank you very much.
So that's the World Doctors, not the World Doctors Alliance, that's the German Doctors Association of Doctors of Enlightenment, they call themselves. Surely we should be paying attention. These guys are saying, well, we've been completely censored. We're contacting the mass media. They're not interested in what we've got to say at all. And he's talking about it as fascistic. So for German doctors to be invoking Goebbels, saying that, well, we've got a fascistic system now happening in Germany, medical voices being censored, is fairly important. I would have thought that should be reported around the world.
Well, I hear what they say. I listen. Other people are saying other things. They're entitled to their view. If they're being censored, then maybe we should listen to what they have to say.
Well, of course we should.
Yeah, but they are a self-selected bunch of people. They've got their views.
So are we.
Yes, indeed. That's right.
So you don't think that what they're saying is true?
I'm sceptical about all voices that I'm hearing. When I hear people like that going about fascism, you feel like saying, do you know about the assassination of Herrhausen? Herrhausen was called...
They're not talking about Herrhausen, Martin. No, they're saying that there's a fascistic government now in Germany, and that they're adopting Goebbels' principles of fear, of using fear to control the population.
Yeah, but the problem with middle-class people like that is that they use the word fascism.
Well, there's not a lot of non-middle-class doctors, are there?
No, there aren't.
So you don't listen to anybody then?
No, but they're not experts in fascism. This is why I was bringing up the Herrhausen case.
Well, they're probably just as much as you are, if their families have lived through Nazi Germany.
No, not necessarily. They're not that... In fact, because they've lived under Nazism, there were a lot of Nazis who basically made a life in Germany at the end of the war, as you well know. The point is that people use these phrases and phraseologies, and they don't really understand. There is a fascist problem in Germany, which is the fact that the United States, through the Red Army faction, killed Herrhausen, who was negotiating behind the scenes with Gorbachev about what was going to happen when the Berlin Wall came down. Nobody's been punished for that, because the trail leads straight back to MI6 and CIA. They are the fascists. That's real fascism. And wearing a mask or not wearing a mask is not really about fascism, is it? It's about something else.
Well, let's go for dissident doctors, middle class, I'm afraid, Martin, in Germany, to the dissident doctors in the United States. They're also middle class. Now, this is a woman called Dr. Gold, and she was involved about a month ago in a speech with a load of other doctors outside the Capitol building in the United States, which got to several million hits on YouTube within about a day and a half, and then it was censored by YouTube. But anyway, she's got some, well, I think, quite important things to say about looking at the sort of smoking gun of the pandemic, which is chloroquine. She's talking here about using this treatment, how effective the treatment is in her experience as a doctor, and also as a lawyer. Interesting to be both at the same time. She's very, very middle class, she is. And so let's hear what she's got to say about the idea of chloroquine. But particularly, pay attention at the end of this clip. This is about 5 minutes long. But at the end of the clip, she explains that in France, chloroquine was prevented from being sold actually in the middle of January, before the so-called pandemic, well, it was a pandemic announced by the World Health Organization, had even taken off, to prevent chloroquine being used even before the pandemic.
I was absolutely warned that it would be a firestorm, but I had no idea. I've heard guests say things like that in the past, but it's an absolutely stunning experience to live through. You know, I am a board-certified emergency physician. I like to take care of patients. And I was watching a tragedy unfold, both on the personal level, where a patient would need a medication that would help them that the FDA says is perfectly fine and safe for 65 years. And then as an American, I'm watching people live through such a censorship and disinformation campaign that I'm watching free speech die. So I think my background as a doctor and a lawyer is really what informs me, and it makes what I'm seeing in front of me so incredibly tragic. I want to emphasize how utterly insane it is that we're having any conversation at all about a 65-year FDA-approved generic medication that's been proven safe for decades. It's so insane that I knew there was much more to it than just the drug, right? It makes no sense whatsoever. So again, I think being a doctor and a lawyer, really, I've always been very passionate about free speech. What we're living through right now, Glenn, unfortunately, we're living through not the end of free speech, but we're right in the middle. We're in the death throes of free speech. When a physician can't speak to their patient and a patient can't speak to their physician, we're seeing the collapse of our entire society. This is what it's based upon. And what do I mean? Of course I've been censored. Of course doctors have been censored. But the patients have also been censored because they've been given so much disinformation that they don't want to ask questions or they don't want a treatment that helps them. So they've both been censored. Let me walk you through this. It's very interesting for your listeners and viewers. So doctors prescribe on-label and off-label all the time. It's irrelevant to a physician. When a drug is approved on-label, for example, for pneumonia, let's say, once it's been approved by the FDA as being safe, you then can use it off-label for another use. So when COVID came around, it looked like chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine would be helpful. So we fully expected to use it off-label. All of a sudden, we were told we couldn't use it off-label anymore. The way we were told that is various governors of various states tell their state medical boards and their state pharmacy boards that a physician can't use this for off-label use. This has never happened in the history of medicine in the past. It's just shocking. I can't even, there is no degree that I can use to tell you the enormity of such a statement. Like everybody else, I actually thought this had to do with President Trump, right? He says hydroxychloroquine is promising, then the media just really poured hatred all over that drug, right? It's about the drug. It turns out I don't think it is. For about 6-8 weeks, that's what I thought too. Then I looked into it a little bit more closely. It turns out that hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine is over-the-counter in much of the world. Interestingly enough, it was over-the-counter in France, all right? You know when it got pulled over-the-counter? Let me explain. Over-the-counter in France, they moved it to a List 2 poisonous substance, which requires a prescription. You know when they did that, Glenn? They did that on January 13th, 2 months before President Trump breathed a word about it. The next question is, why would they do that? And what I will say is you have to always look at who benefits when you knock out one competitor, one contender, right? So hydroxychloroquine works early. To the extent that there's anything else, like remdesivir, that works late. It doesn't work as well, nearly as well as hydroxychloroquine, and it's late. So if you knock out the early drug, there's obviously an opportunity for the late drug. January 13th, why did France pull it off the shelves? We had evidence in 2005 that chloroquine was likely to work against the COVID virus. I say that because the virology journal published by the National Institute of Health showed in SARS-CoV-1, which is the precursor to SARS-CoV-2, which is what we're living through, chloroquine worked prophylactically and in early treatment. So we knew that in 2005, the director of the NIH, which published virology, was Anthony Fauci at that time. So Anthony Fauci clearly knew that chloroquine was likely to work. So my question is, if people want to say, well, we don't know if it works, which, by the way, we do know now, but even if we didn't know back then, a few months ago, that it worked, it was certainly a likely contender, because back in 2005, virology, they published that chloroquine worked for SARS-CoV-1, which is, by the way, 78% identical to SARS-CoV-2, otherwise known as COVID-19. In fact, I don't know why we call it a novel coronavirus. It's not really quite novel. It's 78% identical to SARS-CoV-1. It was predictable that it would work. The most important thing for the American people is that the restriction on hydroxychloroquine is due to overall censorship in our society. When doctors are being censored from what they can say, when there's a narrative of groupthink that we have to follow, everyone in America is going to be in jeopardy. So the biggest overall issue is the censorship and the disinformation campaign. We're seeing it now aggressively with hydroxychloroquine, because if you can get access to hydroxychloroquine, you can live or you cannot be sick. So that's critical. The governors are restricting our ability to do that because they're instituting rules that stop doctors from doing it and empower pharmacists from filling our prescriptions from doing that. So that's the concrete way we're experiencing the disinformation campaign is actually killing people. Harvey Risch, the famous Yale epidemiologist, has estimated that 100,000 mm-hmm. Americans would be alive today, right, if we didn't have this massive disinformation campaign. The other really important thing specifically about the COVID-19 issue, if I could just say this, is that when people like Zuckerberg said that what I was saying mm-hmm. is potentially false information, I'd like to know where he went to medical school, all right? Because when you look at graphs all over the world, let's look at Sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa has the death rates, case fatality rates, like a fraction of what we have, a fraction, maybe like 1% of Western nations. This problem with COVID-19 deaths is predominantly Western European or American problem because we don't have access to chloroquine. You can get chloroquine in Latin America. You can get chloroquine in Africa. You can get chloroquine over the counter most of these places. You could get it over the counter in France and in Mexico before this whole thing started. I would like to just give my patients hydroxychloroquine and zinc, which will save their lives, and also remove the spiderweb of fear that has overtaken Americans. We need to eliminate the spiderweb of fear. It's not the COVID-19 that's doing us in. It's a spiderweb of fear. Let's give Americans a way to say, you know what, I'm really afraid of this thing, so you know what, let me go to the pharmacy, let me just pick this up and grab it, put it in my pocket in case I need it. Other Americans who aren't as panicked over it can just go about their lives. Either way, both groups can go about their lives. I implore All President right. Trump, it has gotten so bad, so dangerous, please, let's make this over-the-counter, or let's make it on-label usage at the very least.
Well, there was a bit of a lecture on chloroquine, or hydroxychloroquine, which are basically the same thing. This is a medicine that's been around for 65 years, Martin, and suddenly it's made just... I mean, this to me looks like a kind of smoking gun of the conspiracy of the plandemic. You've got January the 13th, the French government, before there was any real understanding of this. I mean, it was the virus had taken off in Wuhan. It certainly hadn't taken off in this part of the world. This is 2 months before the first of the lockdowns began. And the French government are taking it off the list of medicines that you can just get without a prescription. They're saying it's now a poison that you can only get with a prescription. And yet for 65 years, this medicine has been deemed perfectly safe by the world's medical authorities. So it looks to me as if what they're trying to do by getting hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine off the market, making it unavailable, is to force people to take more expensive treatments of some sort, or even just to increase the number of people who are dying. She's saying there in the United States there are 100,000 people who potentially maybe wouldn't have died if they'd have been given chloroquine at an early stage in their catching this virus.
Well, I think the idea that the pharmaceutical companies in the West are extremely bad actors is pretty clear, and they've got their agenda. On a slight tangent to that, the Russians claimed about 3 or 4 weeks ago that they had got a vaccine. And don't forget that in Russia and China, the production of vaccines and of other drugs is controlled by the government. There's no private sector profit to be made. And what the US did was they then put sanctions on the laboratories in Russia which had developed this trial vaccine on the grounds that they were basically a biological or chemical weapons facility. And that just goes to show that everybody is playing politics with whatever this thing is. I come back all the time to the timeline. The banking system started to collapse in September. In November, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States that a pandemic was coming out of China. How did they know?
So 100,000 people potentially dead. This sort of tallies a bit with people who are saying that actually Bill Gates is a eugenicist.
Well, if you think about it, the 9/11 attacks, which we talked about last week and the week before, killed probably 3,000 people on the day and then led to the deaths of possibly
millions
yeah. subsequently. These people are quite capable of doing nasty stuff. Of course they are. We know they are.
Okay, so let's... what about the British role? Because the thing is, the Brits have been researching the common cold for many years. In fact, they started to do it. We started to do it, I say they, a place called the Harvard Hospital in Salisbury, which, by the way, was part of a US operation too. The US were in there with the Brits at the end of the Second World War. Now, funnily enough, when I was working as a reporter for the BBC in Salisbury, I actually went and did a report. It was probably a 5-minute report. It ended up maybe as a 7-minute thing on this Common Cold Research Unit, which had just about to be demolished and built on at the Harvard Hospital. It hadn't been used for a few years. But I thought I'd dig out something about this Common Cold Research Unit, because certainly my contacts in the Journalist Union say, although they always denied it, it was closely connected to Porton Down. Is that possible, Martin?
Well, it probably is. And as you know, you interviewed the journalist from BBC journalist from Salisbury.
Ah, right.
Who broke the story
he's a Bristol journalist, Steve Brody, who's the Home Affairs correspondent for Points West.
We know that in Porton Down, they were basically injecting National Service people with sarin. And they were copying or building on the work that had been done by Nazi and Japanese scientists during the war.
The question is, why would anybody want to go and get a disease? The fact of the matter is they didn't realise it was the military doing this Harvard Hospital. And here, let's have a little listen to this. This is a minute and a half or so. This is the little sort of TV trailer thing. I suppose it would have been played in cinemas and things like this. Pathé News or whatever, which was telling people what they could expect at Harvard Hospital in Salisbury at the Common Cold Research Unit. And let's just stress, the common cold is known in the virology world, Martin, as the coronavirus.
They're all coronaviruses.
They're not all coronaviruses, not the flu ones too, are they?
No, flu isn't coronavirus.
Research Unit is the coronavirus. So let's have a listen now to this report from the 1960s.
At the Common Cold Research Unit at Harvard Hospital, Salisbury, there's literally a stream of people volunteering to catch cold. Yes, I know it sounds mad, but as Dr. Craig, in charge of the unit, will explain, it's an essential part of the research to try and find a cure. First, Dr. Craig explains what they're in for. If they're lucky, they'll get a fortnight in isolation with a streaming cold. Because that's what a common cold is, of course, a runny nose. And if a volunteer is inoculated with some of the discharge, she can catch a cold, too. The cold's then treated with a variety of vaccines, and blood samples are taken to check the effect. The problem with the common cold is that many different viruses can cause it, and so far it's proved impossible to make a vaccine which will combat them all. Various viruses are cultured and classified, and the nasal discharges from volunteers are examined and prepared for inoculation into other volunteers. Fertile eggs are inoculated with influenza viruses to produce cultures of attenuated viruses of the disease, designed, that is, to cause only a mild attack. As far as the volunteers are concerned, you could say it's a great life if they don't weaken. All mod cons and lots of lovely viruses.
So there you got it. That's the Salisbury Harvard Hospital Common Cold Research Unit. He starts off there, isn't he, saying, I know it sounds mad. Well, to a certain extent, it was mad, wasn't it, Martin? Because they never found a cure to the common cold. So what were they up to there?
Well, you have to ask yourself the question, why do you want to find a cure for the common cold? Flu, I can understand, because that can kill you. Colds don't kill people. Why? And basically, we've had to put up with them for presumably millions
of years.
But
they're more contagious. So maybe someone is thinking, we are looking at something which can be really, really, really contagious to spread around the world. Biological weapons, perhaps.
Well, I mean, what has been going on since the end of World War II is research and use of biological and chemical weapons. The Western powers used biological and chemical weapons in Korea during the Korean War. And various people, and people can check this, there's been lots of research on it. They basically dropped all sorts of viruses and they infected insects as vectors for viruses. And, of course, the research they claimed at the time was in order to protect people. And, of course, under the Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention, which is another convention which the Americans haven't signed, so the Russians have signed it, and as Craig Murray pointed out, they dismantled all of their chemical and biological warfare facilities in the 1990s during the Yeltsin era. So they haven't got any Novichok, for example. Who has got Novichok? Obviously the Bundeswehr's laboratory, which has found Novichok supposedly on Navalny's plastic bottle that he left in the hotel, which his mates went back and found.
A bit like the perfume bottle.
Yeah, a bit like the perfume bottle. But of course, what they call the chain of custody of that bottle is corrupt. Basically,
anybody
could have put it there. That's right. And of course, they've only been able to identify it as Novichok originally from that bottle, from the German military laboratory.
You can see why the German doctors are invoking Goebbels here, can't you? Because there's just no rigorous questioning by journalists going on at all in this.
Well, I mean, Ulficker, what's his name?
Ulf Kotti,
he said, well, basically the whole German press is run by the CIA. And as we well know, the CIA and the German intelligence services at the end of the war were melded together. So we're dealing with the same people. Reinhard Gehlen, who ended up running the BND, used to run the Gestapo. And from a Russian point of view, it's pretty obvious what's going on here. You are the same people that you always were. Nothing much has changed.
Anyway, let's bring this analysis by the doctors themselves, the censored doctors. I mean, they are certainly not appearing. None of these people are appearing on mainstream press here in the UK, even though they've got fascinating things to say. And, of course, this is all in the run-up to the end of the month, where the vaccine industry and Big Pharma desperately wants the government to renew the Coronavirus Act. So let's hear from, he's called Zach Cox, he's a local dentist. We had him on this programme a few weeks ago anonymously, but he's now very much more in the open. In discussion earlier today, actually, this was just recorded this morning, with Professor Dolores Cahill from Ireland, talking about something which they're developing. In fact, they talk about all sorts of stuff here, but in the background is this whole thing called the World Doctors Alliance, which is forming almost as we speak.
We have these beautiful things called immune systems. And what people, just to remind them of their immune system, is that, say, if you're a child, chickenpox, I think, is a good example, because people our age would remember it. You would be unwell, you know, for about a week. And then you have this beautiful immune response that keeps you healthy. Nobody dies from chickenpox. And then in the natural cycle, every 2 or 3 years, the next generation of children would get chickenpox, you know, so that for the rest of your life, if you were around children like a grandparent or a teacher, you would be naturally boosted by them getting chickenpox. You'd come across the virus, your immune system, you wouldn't get sick again. It would be boosted. And that's how you get this thing called immune for life. So what really happens is coronaviruses, some viruses are there every month of the year, but influenza and coronaviruses in the Northern Hemisphere cause flu-like symptoms in some people in the wintertime. So it turns out about 80 to 98% of people that come across coronaviruses don't have any symptoms. And the reason for that is their previous immunity to coronaviruses, which were flu, and they happen every few years, every 2 or 3 years, and a common cold, means that when they come across the coronavirus, they're not sick at all. Their immune system is boosted. They get rid of the virus straight away. So they won't even have PCR because the virus doesn't actually infect them. 80% of people don't have antibodies, but they're completely healthy. That can be between 80 and 98% of the population. And then for between 15 and 2% or whatever of the population, they might get the symptoms. But once you've had the symptoms, so everybody, if you're getting it in February, everyone will be entirely immune and well within 3 weeks. And that's, you see, the peak. That means everybody's healthy. It turns out, we'll say in Ireland, you know, you have a chance of 1 in 500,000 of dying. But if that person knew and was given treatment when they had symptoms in the 2 weeks or so, they wouldn't die. And then after that, it's like chickenpox, you're immune from that virus. The virus then weakens Even if you come across it, nobody is sick. It's still in the environment. So once you get to April, May, June, you don't need to test anymore. Finished. It's gone. And there is no such thing as a second spike. There is no such thing as a second spike. The population of the world, everybody comes across it. They're immune. They're well. They're healthy. Stop testing. And I just want to add that in the 2019-2020 winter season, we had influenza A, influenza B, and coronavirus circulating. You know, when the pandemic was called, this coronavirus caused only 1% of the annual flu deaths, your average year, right? It would be like if we were testing for the influenza strains that were circulating this year and making everybody panic about it. But everyone goes, oh yeah, I had flu, you know, in December, I'm well now. You could be as easily testing for the influenza that people had 6 months ago and counting cases. It's irrelevant. People had influenza this winter, the winter before. They're just testing to see if you have fragments of influenza or coronavirus. You're not sick in the summertime. And also, of course, because people are not sick, you don't need to wear masks. You don't need to social distance. You don't need to do anything. You don't need to quarantine. You don't need to actually have a vaccine because we have the immune system that keeps us healthy.
Yeah, the immune system. If only we would learn to trust in nature instead of into pharmaceuticals. But so let me get this right. So asymptomatic people are healthy. They're normal, healthy people, right?
Yeah. What you could be calling us is asymptomatic for chickenpox, right? It's a bit like we all had, you know, if you had a flu last December, you don't really characterize. I don't go around saying I'm asymptomatic for chickenpox or I'm asymptomatic for influenza A. I'm someone who had an infection, you know, because all of us have thousands of viruses. We come in the air. So I think we need to actually push back. We are healthy people who happen to have a flu that circulated influenza and coronavirus. We're healthy.
That's exactly what I'm driving at. We're healthy, normal people. So like you say, no need for any of these lockdown measures whatsoever. And yet I just read in the Telegraph just now, they're planning already to clear out the hospitals. To clear beds again into the care homes. And that last time was an absolute disaster because you sent infected people to the most frail, and elderly, most precious people, you know, our mums and dads and our grandparents. Are they going to do it again? You don't need a PhD in rocket science to work out that sending sick people into care homes is going to be a disaster.
And I suppose exactly, Zach, that's why we should publicise as well that you and I are going to be speaking at a rally in Trafalgar Square on the tomorrow, the 19th of September, from noon to 5 o'clock. And also I'm involved in an organization, it's ISOFIA, and they are coordinating rallies all over the world. So there's about 20 countries all on the 19th. Berlin as well have just contacted me this morning to say there's going to have a huge rally on the 10th of October, 2020. And also I should say as well, Doctors Alliance with Dr. Mohammed Adil, who actually got removed from his position in the United Kingdom and his license taken away for a year because he spoke accurately about four publications around hydroxychloroquine. So the World Doctors Alliance is on Sunday, the 20th of September, between, I think, 5 o'clock for 3 hours UK time.
And that's worlddoctorsalliance.com.
Worlddoctorsalliance.com. And actually, Dr. Heiko Schrodinger from the Doctors Alliance in Germany has actually kindly said that he would speak on the World Doctors Alliance. And we, you know, are working with him and people all over the world now to coordinate the various initiatives. But I think when you're talking about the grandparents, right, instead of talking about clearing the hospitals, why aren't they just saying, you know, hydroxychloroquine, for example, you just need one tablet and it works at 100 milligrams, one of the safest drugs. One tablet will keep you safe for a month. So all we need to do is get the doctors to prescribe one tablet for the elderly, we'll say. It costs about £2, one tablet once a month of the safest drug, and it would protect them. And you don't need a vaccine. They don't need mass social distancing lockdown. So I think we really need to push back that the politicians and the doctors, by not giving preventative safe drugs, are actually going to cause illness and unnecessary death, and they are entirely preventable. And that's what we're saying, that if you as a politician or a doctor are not doing something that will cause death, it's actually professionally and legally a crime called malfeasance. And in the United Kingdom, you can go to prison for 10 years. And what the malfeasance is going on here is they are not making doctors and politicians and policymakers. A safe drug available that will prevent illness and death. It's well known now. Instead of locking down and closing the hospital and social distancing and masks and, you know, having fear, provide safe and effective drugs and stop the lockdown.
So that's our very own Dr. Zach Cox from Glastonbury speaking, the dentist speaking with Professor Dolores Carhill. Up until all this happened, she was one of the world's top epidemiologists, super expert in all this stuff. And both of them have lost their jobs. Martin, it's a bit annoying to see you smirking there when we're talking about those people losing their jobs.
No.
Yeah, you were saying, well, I was saying, well, they've lost their jobs as a result of speaking out, and you were smiling.
No, I was not, Tony. I'm listening to what they're saying. What I would say is we've heard lots of doctors who are opposed to what's happening at the moment. We haven't heard any single doctor, medical doctor, on this programme arguing in favour of the government's policies. Now, I'm not necessarily in favour of government policy, but these people are entitled to their view.
We're going to hear
what they say.
But the thing is, the doctors are not driving the policy. The policy's being driven by people like Bill Gates. And we're going to be hearing from him now on his view on the COVID vaccines.
He's got no medical qualifications whatsoever.
And anyway, anyone wants to hear what doctors are going to say on, then you just turn the BBC on or any of the mainstream press, they're all over it. These are the censored doctors we're hearing.
Well, indeed, and they shouldn't be censored. I'm totally in favour of people having their say. But I don't necessarily, as a non-medical person, I'd like to hear from other medical people what they think. I don't just want to hear one side of it.
Well, you can just switch on the BBC then when you get home.
Well, indeed, I do. I mean, I'm basically listening to this and I'm listening to the mainstream.
Actually, they did have on BBC Question Time last night various different views. One of them was a supposedly medically qualified person who was saying completely opposite to what you've just heard, that we're not doing anywhere near enough, we need to be locking down more. Mm-hmm. And the only voice which was speaking against was a businessman.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are various views,
you know, what
of
would
different
be great,
people
and we,
about
this,
what we need and do not need to do. Both,
said
the economics,
many times,
I'm prepared to enter into an argument. The medical stuff, I'm just listening.
The many times, you know, I've said this, that I would love to see the two big proponents of this on a live TV debate. That is to say, Andrew Wakefield, who's been banging on about the dangers of vaccines for the last 15 years or so, since he did a study at King's College in London with some other doctors, which he was saying, which was later rejected by the Lancet or taken out of the Lancet, and he was supposedly discredited. But what he'd found was links between the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, and autism, and saying that basically the vaccine was more harmful to the children than helpful, which he was then punished for. But it'd be interesting to hear him then up against Bill Gates, who's a world expert, Martin, wouldn't it? And that's a doctor that actually knows their stuff, rather than somebody who's a megabucks monopolist who seems to be controlling World Health Organization policy.
Well, Bill Gates has got no grounds to claim any specialist knowledge whatsoever.
No, but
he's clearly a multimillionaire friend of the National Security Agency, which is how he's been allowed to dominate the internet. But of course, he's got no basis. You know, his views are frankly worthless.
By the way,
far less of any interest than any of the doctors that you've had.
Well, you
what
say
I'd be interested
worthless.
To hear is, I'd be interested.
We're about to hear from Bill Gates.
Yes, but I'd be
he's the guy in charge.
I'd be interested to hear from doctors who disagree with what the doctors we've been listening to are saying.
Well, like I say, go and turn the BBC.
Well, indeed.
You see thousands.
Indeed. And
of them.
What you'll find is that most people are listening to the BBC and not to our show. And they generally tend to believe the doctors that they say on the BBC.
They've
don't
still
they?
Got their jobs. Anyway, indeed. So Bill Gates, let's have a listen to him now, talking about these COVID vaccines this week.
The private sector companies have the expertise to do the trials and do the manufacturing. And we have, you know, they've stepped up. The distribution of vaccines, you know, rich countries, logistically, that's not a huge problem. As you say, it's probably more limited by the attitudes of the people there. For the developing countries, an effort called Gavi that the U.S. has been a big back rub buys vaccines for the poorest countries and gets them out to all the children of the world. And that's brought childhood death, yearly death of children, down from over 10 million a year now to less than 5 million. So it's a great organization. The U.S. Congress knows it well and has backed it. And they'll, you know, working together with other agencies, they'll have the lead on this procurement piece. and cooperating with the individual countries for the distribution.
I'm assuming, Bill, you've approached the Trump administration for support for this global manufacturing and distribution plan. How responsive has the U.S. government been so far?
Yeah, I'm talking to Republicans and Democrats, you know, Congress, executive branch. You know, when it looked like there would be a supplemental bill, it looked like at least $4 billion for the vaccine was going to get into there. Now it's not clear whether there'll be a supplemental bill, which is unfortunate because that would have been a great vehicle. Because, you know, when we talk about ending the U.S. epidemic, that global peace has to be part of that overall picture. If there's not a supplemental bill at some point, I do think there'll be an opportunity to have that money come forward. It's literally the billions you have to spend to save trillions. It'll be the highest impact part of whatever allocation gets made.
So that's Bill Gates there talking about his ideas for the vaccine, also obviously lobbying away very, very strongly. He wants a new bill through Congress. He says it's going to cost billions, but they'll save trillions.
The obvious thing to say about him is he said the private sector can deal with this. Why should the private sector have anything to do with medical production whatsoever? In Russia, as I mentioned earlier, the state-run research institutes have already come up with a vaccine, which they are prepared to give away. Why does Gates talk about we're going to need lots of taxpayer money for private companies to produce a vaccine?
He has saved millions of lives, he says.
Well, so he claims. Now, the fact of the matter is, he is not the right person to argue about this with anybody. He's got no medical qualifications whatsoever, and he's only become a billionaire because he was a friend of the secret state in the United States, and he was allowed to set up Microsoft with back doors, which allowed the NSA, who we mentioned earlier, to see into everybody's computers.
By the way, I've now got one of the NSA directors is also a director of Amazon, in case people didn't know.
Well, there we are. So, anyway, in other words, these people, I totally agree with the plandemic critics. These people are not to be trusted.
Anyway, let's look at Gates's claims there about having saved so many people. In an article by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he says, and talking about Bill Gates and his messiah complex, he says that Gates promised to eradicate polio with $1.2 billion. Gates took control of India's National Advisory Board and mandated 50 polio vaccines, up from 5 to every child before the age of 5. The Indian doctors now blame the Gates campaign for a devastating vaccine strain polio epidemic that paralysed nearly 500,000 children in India between 2000 and 2017. In 2017, the Indian government dialed back Gates' vaccine regime and evicted Bill Gates and his cronies from the NAB. The polio paralysis rates have been dropping as a result. So back in 2014, though, Gates Foundation funded tests of experimental HPV vaccines developed by GlaxoSmithKline and Merck on 23,000 young girls in remote Indian provinces. Approximately 1,200 suffered severe side effects. So that's roughly, is that 5% roughly of those? Severe side effects, including autoimmune and fertility disorders. 7 actually died, so maybe they shouldn't have had the vaccine in the first place. The Indian government investigation charged that Gates funded researchers committed pervasive ethical violations, pressurising vulnerable village girls into the trial, bullying parents, forging consent forms, and also refusing medical care to the injured girls. The case is now in the country's Supreme Court. In 2010, Gates Foundation funded a trial of GlaxoSmithKline's experimental malaria vaccine and killed 151 African infants, caused serious adverse effects, including paralysis, seizure, and febrile convulsions in 20% of the children that they treated. That is to say, over 1,000 kids were severely damaged by the experimental malaria vaccine. He's experimenting on people, Martin. This is Dr. Mengele allowed to have free reign, and this man's name is Bill Gates.
at least Dr. Mengele was a doctor. Bill Gates isn't a doctor. What he is, as we explained earlier, he's basically, we call them philanthropists. In Russia, they're called oligarchs. He's an oligarch. A criminal oligarch.
So why
anybody takes anything he says seriously?
The question is, the big question here is, how come none of the people that are interviewing him are asking him any of these questions about all these people he's killed?
Well, because he's very powerful, isn't he? I mean, when he goes on about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation giving all this money away to save people, it turns out that what he's doing is seeding profit for his own investments in the vaccine companies, which are then going to provide the so-called answer to the problems. And of course, the reason why this is all wrong, because it's all being done for personal profit at the end of the day. The idea that he's a philanthropist is ludicrous. And of course, there are other parts of the world where this stuff isn't done like that. And you know where they are? They're in communist China, Cuba,
well,
and Russia.
Yes, and there's all sorts of other things going
well,
on.
Well, yes,
there.
But anyway, the point is, it's not, they're not producing medicines for profit.
Okay, so maybe they're just killing people anyway through other means.
Well, indeed, but the point is that this is what gets me about this whole plandemic conspiracy movement, is that they're not distinguishing between the Western part of the world, including the Third World, which is under the thumb of the West, and the non-Western parts of the world, including China, which is at least one quarter of humanity, where production of medical goods is not for private profit. And of course, you can still get it wrong, but a private profit system is bound to get it wrong, because the motivation's all wrong.
But if things are going wrong in China, Martin, as we saw right at the very beginning of the pandemic, with the no notice being taken whatsoever of all the doctors over there, the same sort of thing was
going
indeed,
on. Just because you don't have a private profit-run system doesn't mean that you can't mess up. But the point is that you're not going to mess up in the same kind of way as a private profit-run system.
It seems to me, though, that the real criminals are the media here, in that simply not addressing any of these questions, so that these powerful people are now in the position where they can pick and choose, oh, we will be interviewed by this person, we will get all the questions beforehand, and anybody that asks any questions, we will never speak to again.
Well, the media, as we've discussed earlier in the programme, is basically the servant of the powerful. Well, of course it is. Yeah. I mean, that's what it's there
for.
Where
have they got their shares, I wonder? So this is why I still think the BBC is an important thing to keep.
Well, indeed, that's right. And of course, flawed as it is, it's better than just having naked commercial interests deciding what is and what is not allowed to be said.
Anyway, you might agree with Bill Gates a bit about some of the conspiracy theorists, because he talked about that as well.
The conspiracy theorists who believe that you helped to create and spread the coronavirus might be easy to dismiss if there weren't so many of them. Has that notoriety become an impediment to your efforts or the foundation's work yet?
Well, it's so crazy, you know, to suggest the opposite, which is, you know, we make vaccines and that has saved, you know, millions of lives, to somehow say that the vaccine in general is malign, or that, you know, the deaths aren't really taking place. It's surprising to me how interesting that is. So it spreads far more quickly than the truth. The big concern is that if that means that the protection of others, like wearing masks, or a willingness of enough people to take the vaccine, then it absolutely does make things worse. And the idea of how should these social media platforms try and avoid being the source of these sort of weirdly interesting falsehoods, that's a debate or discussion we're gonna have to continue to have.
So there's Bill Gates again, but this time he's saying that the social media platforms are the source. He's saying that he really wants Facebook to kind of start clamping down on this. Well, they already have to a certain extent. But Martin, of course, the social media platforms are not the source. The people writing about it are the source. And actually, for a large extent, the mainstream press are the source. A lot of the articles that are being shared on social media, which contradict the official narrative, are mainstream press articles. They're just little obscure ones buried away, etc. So He's also saying that he's been a bit cheeky, isn't he? Saying that the detractors of Bill Gates, people are pointing the finger at him as a megalomaniac oligarch with a messiah complex, saying that he created the vaccine and he's spreading it. Well, that isn't necessarily what anyone is saying. They're saying basically that he's manipulating World Health Organization policy. It's not the same thing at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, he's exaggerating the criticisms that are being made of him so that he can then other the people who are making them. And what was crossing my mind as we're talking about all of this, what is the biggest killer of children on the planet, Tony? Is it malaria? Is it tetanus? Is it COVID? What is the biggest killer?
Poverty.
Diarrhea. Bad water. And the way you solve
cholera?
The way you solve that is you need to build decent housing for people with toilets, which is what they've done in communist China, but failed to do in capitalist India, and millions of people have to shit in the street, and that kills loads of people in Bangladesh, all over the world, and if you wanted to do something to save the poor, then you provide some plumbing. And that's what needs to happen. Not vaccination.
Decent water systems, yeah, absolutely agree with that. In fact, Ian Neal used to do that, didn't he? He was an old friend of ours from the 9/11 Truth campaign.
Yeah. I mean, don't forget that all of our discussions about medical problems are skewed by the skewed nature of our society.
Well, it's the media mainly, isn't it? Surely the media is mostly doing this. It's not just the media is not reflecting society. It's trying to steer society.
Well, the media reflects the powerful. That's the problem. And therefore, we think about problems in the world as framed by that media, also, which is controlled by the powerful.
I mean,
real issues are the ones we've just identified.
Having worked in the mainstream media myself, you know that the editors love sensationalism. Anything that's a real sensation, and this is great for them. They are great. You know, this is the latest sensation to do with this vaccine, the virus, blah, blah, blah. This is the sort of thing they jump on.
Well, there's also a tendency for people to like controversy to make news and media as well. People like a row. But the other thing is, of course, ultimately, the media is controlled by the powerful. So the biggest issues, for example, the collapse of the financial system in September 2019. If you went out and asked people in the street here what happened in the financial system in 2019 in September, they would look at you blankly. But it's the most important thing that's happened since 2008. Far more money has been shoveled down the bank's greedy maw since this crisis began than we did in 2008. But everybody's talking about COVID, COVID, COVID. And of course, they're not also talking about, we're talking about global warming, we're not talking about nuclear war, because we're actually very close to the possibility of an accidental nuclear war. But rather than talking about that, we're talking about COVID, we're talking about, there's a whole hierarchy of stupidity here.
Bill Gates also, though, has some things to say about China. Any idea what he's, before we hear from him, Martin, what you think Gates' attitude to China is, positive or negative?
I imagine he's trying to finesse it in such a way that he's trying to help everybody, including the Chinese.
Well, the U.S.-China relations have gotten very complex, and of course, as one side doesn't trust the other, then the other side does things that you can get a negative spiral. That will be a complex political issue. I do think there are cases where we can have win-win, where we're working on solving medical problems, working together on climate change innovation. So I'd hate to see this, what some people talk about, this complete decoupling. I think that would be a lose-lose. Well, I wouldn't say we're interdependent. We benefit from each other in terms of, the U.S. sells jet engines and entertainment, and we used to want to sell, expensive chips that would create high-paying jobs. And so I think you have to really decide where is there still mutual benefit. I doubt, and I don't think that's come down to no mutual benefit between two countries that are, and I fully understand this, increasingly wary of each other's behavior.
So there's Bill Gates' analysis of China. He's playing a very straight bat there, really seeing it as a market, I suppose, for his products. And you can tell he'd actually like the Americans to get on quite well with the Chinese. But, I mean, he's also, I mean, what he's saying earlier, really, I suppose, is more important, isn't it? But he's accusing people like us, or me anyway, not you, of saying that the vaccine is malign. And I think that the statistics just make the point. I've just read out those statistics from the Robert Kennedy article, that actually, if you're going to inoculate people and 20% of those children are then going to have ill effects and several of them die, then maybe that can be considered a malign vaccine. Vaccines originally, didn't they start, I think, in the 1770s here, not very far away, Martin, the very first vaccine?
Well, the vaccination, what did take place in other parts, I think in China they used to do it as well. But of course, you know, it was Edward Jenner, and of course Edward Jenner did the classic thing. He inoculated a local poor boy with cowpox. He didn't vaccinate his own children to start with. And of course what the Western drug companies do is they go out to poor countries and say, we will give you free stuff because you're poor. And of course basically they're just experimenting on them to see whether they die. And when, and of course, all the pharmaceutical companies are concerned about is making money from selling stuff to rich people. There are basic cures for lots and lots of things which people cannot access because they simply haven't got the money. And of course, there's no interest for the pharmaceutical companies in providing basic care for people in poor countries. There's no money to be made from it, so they're not interested in it. Whereas in actual fact, if you wanted to save lives and build quality of life, you would basically provide free healthcare to poor people at very cheap cost. But there's no money to be made in that. But of course, that's, you know, Che Guevara was a doctor before he became a revolutionary soldier. And China and Cuba, the Cubans, for example, go all over the world doing stuff for people because that's what their system's
okay,
about.
So Edward Jenner discovered that cowpox in the 1770s could be injected into people and they would catch cowpox, but that would make them immune to smallpox. I'm just suggesting right now that because there is this strain of COVID-19 out there called D614G, it's a mutation of the coronavirus, which, according to Newsweek, and I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and various other publications, is a less deadly strain of coronavirus. So whatever it was that you say it's genetically engineered, I think you're probably right about that.
Possibly.
You're probably right. So whatever it was that was genetically engineered into this coronavirus originally, the COVID-19, has mutated. So it's not quite so nasty as it used to be. Why not take a little bit of D614G, inject it into somebody and see if it makes them immune to the more virulent version?
Well, one of the things that's been happening, if you've been paying attention, is they've taken blood from people who've had COVID-19 and they're using it to inject into people as a potential vaccine. These are deep waters, but as an economist, I would say the real problem is that we're trying to solve the wrong problems. The real problems are out there, and they are not identified in the mainstream media. And of course, the thing about a virus like this, which can spread from everywhere, is even rich people are made to feel frightened of it. Whereas, of course, when babies die of diarrhea in Bangladesh, that's no threat to wealthy people, is it? Whereas if they're a source of virus, then it might come back and bite you in the bum, you know. So that this, you know, the whole narrative around everything is corrupted by money and power, and that's the bottom line.
Okay, so there's a fantastic little documentary out there. It's one of those things that you would hope that the mainstream media, of course, they won't make things like this. It's called Who Controls the Gates Family. So let's have a listen to an excerpt from that now.
During this time, not only has Bill Gates stated an explicit interest in population control, but he's also invested in pharmaceutical and agricultural giants like Monsanto, who have a notorious reputation for the outright disregard of human life. Not only that, but meaningful amounts of Monsanto chemicals can be found in Bill Gates' investments like Starbucks drinks and baked goods, Beyond Meat products, and Impossible Foods burgers. These chemicals have been proven to cause cancer and infertility. Sounds like some master plan laid out by one of the world's greatest boogeymen. But Bill Gates is just one guy. Who is really the driving force behind him?
Who is the real financial powerhouse behind all of these companies? Who is the man behind the curtain? Well, I won't keep you waiting. If you follow the money, you arrive at one place. Bain & Company. Bain & Company was founded in 1973 by former bigwigs at the Boston Consulting Group. And those bigwigs and their families now own sports teams like the Boston Celtics, New England Patriots, and the Boston Red Sox. Multi-billionaires who sit on the board of the Federal Reserve. Bain & Company is one of the big three elite management consulting firms who has been notoriously secretive about itself and its work for clients, earning it the title of the KGB of consulting over the years. You might have heard of Bain & Company during Mitt Romney's run for presidency. The two most famous people out of Bain are Dick Cheney and Mitt Romney. Of course, Dick Cheney was vice president under the Bush administration, and Mitt Romney almost became president. Mitt Romney himself started off at Boston Consulting Group, where he worked alongside none other than Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Eventually, Mitt Romney went on to work for Bain, where he quickly rose up the ranks, becoming one of the company's vice presidents by the late 70s, heading Bain's venture capital arm called Bain Capital. You might not ever guess this, but the wholesome Mormon Mitt Romney was there through it all, quite literally shaping the culture and realities of the United States and countries around the world through Bain Company. While Bain functions as a private equity firm, I think we can quite confidently say that Bain Company is a U.S. intelligence front and military industrial company, since some of the most famous people out of Bain are high-level government officials. And Bain's most famous clients were and are Halliburton, Raytheon, Monsanto, Microsoft, Starbucks, and even the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
So there you have it, Bain and Company, Martin, the regular attendees at the Bilderberg Conference.
Yeah, and BlackRock have taken over the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in the United States in September last year. They're a private hedge fund, and they have been contracted to bail out the banks, and they've bailed themselves out, and they've bailed all the banks out.
And I suppose
to the tune of billions of dollars of taxpayers' money.
So this is
what, but nobody's talking about any of that, because we are now, but I'm just saying that's the whole thing is a scam.
The Germans are talking about when they German doctors are talking about, and I've got a lot of time for those fellas. When they say it's organised crime, really, that's what they're saying. These businesses are organised crime.
Well, they are organised crime, and of course, the 9/11 attacks wasn't carried out by some, jihadis in a cave in Afghanistan. Quite clear, as Donald Trump pointed out on the day, those buildings were bombed. Of course, they were bombed, and they weren't bombed by Muslim fanatics. They were bombed by the US security forces, who are basically representing the corporations who profited from the subsequent wars. And if this COVID attack, 19 attack, whatever it is, let's say for the sake of argument that the COVID-19 attack is a psychological warfare operation with no real basis, the purpose of all of this is to cover up the bailing out of the banks and the procedure of setting up World War III to break China before it's too big. That's what we're talking about here. And of course, there's lots of poor countries who are now, their debts have massively increased as a result of what's been happening, and they're all going to default, which will bring the banks down at some point because this bubble is still, the stock market in this country and elsewhere is at the highest it's ever been, even as the GNP collapses. That just goes to show you that some people are profiting from the crisis, and they're the people probably who started the crisis one way or another.
Anyway, we're going to go and have a look now at another thing, which is censored pretty much, which is good music. I met a chap called Mark Devlin here in Bristol at the Stand Up X protest at the end of last month, Sunday the 30th, I think it was, of August. Mark, like me, has been booted off the airwaves around about the same time as me, in fact. He was a music DJ on Oxford radio station, and I, of course, was doing the BCFM's weekly politics show. We hope, by the way, to be back in November. We're not holding our breath because we shall see whether or not manager Pat Hart actually appreciates what we're doing rather than putting people in there who's leaving who are just kind of reading stuff out from Reuters and things like that. But anyhow, because we try and do an analysis, which is looking much behind, and particularly with, you know, I've got 30 years of sources that we've got, you know, contacts to use as well. So anyway, Mark is taking a very, I think, fascinating look at much of what we see around us, and he is particularly annoyed at the way music has
been
taken over.
He
says anyway it's been taken over, but he's saying effectively that music since the 1990s has been denuded deliberately, and the basically most of the stuff that's coming out now is nonsense. And he's actually gone to the trouble to write two books about it. It's Musical Truth 1 and 2, and I spoke to Mark earlier this week.
I've been researching these subjects for the last 10 years, and it's been the foundation of my two books, Musical Truth. And it's been a fascinating path of research because I've gone all the way back to the early days of the industry, the 1950s, when all the major record labels got going. And in America, you had the emergence of Elvis Presley and rock and roll artists like Bill Haley and the Comets. And then you had in Britain the emergence of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who and bands like this. I've looked at the 60s counterculture coming out of America and how that was a massive social engineering operation at the hands of the CIA. Looking at parallels with the UK counterculture scene of the 60s, then later the rave and acid house scene that came out of Britain in the late 1980s, evidence to suggest that that's another social engineering operation. So all these things, and more recently the occult symbolism that's been going into music videos from all the big artists that have been popular the past few years, like Lady Gaga and Rihanna and Jay-Z and Beyonce and Katy Perry and people like this. But really, looking at the music industry in 2020, it makes me wonder whether the architects of all of this, the mind controllers, feel that they're done with it, which is a horrifying thought. But I raised this question in an interview that I did a few weeks ago on an American show, and it just seems to me that they've done so much social engineering and so much societal programming, and they've put the symbolism in there and they've used it to push agendas. And I just wonder if they're done with that aspect of culture now, because there are no real artists that stand out anymore. There are no real scenes or genres. I gave the example on the show of the other week of, you take it back to the 90s and you had, you know, drum and bass and grunge and house music and hip hop. And you take it back a bit further, you had in the 80s, New Romantic, that whole sound, synth pop. You had Two Tone. You had post-punk, new wave, all these different scenes. And we don't seem to have that anymore. We don't have any of these movements or trends that people can relate to. And the artists just all seem very generic, and there's nothing that makes one particularly stand out from another, apart from how dark and occultic their videos can be. And I just wonder if, you know, the engineers of all of this have just decided that they've achieved all they can through the music industry as a tool for programming and indoctrination.
It's interesting, isn't it, how so much of the music in the 60s and 70s, for example, was uplifting, positive vibes, lots and lots of interesting ideas in that music and in the lyrics about sort of freedom and independence. Yet now that all seems to have gone. So I suppose the effect of the music now could even be people searching around, young people searching around for where this, you know, where they get to get the next tune from. It actually has having a sort of demoralizing effect on masses and masses of young people.
Yeah, and I would challenge anyone to name me, let's even say three. I was going to say five songs. Let's whittle it down to three. Three songs in mainstream pop music. So by that, I mean records that were chart hits, that got heavy rotation on radio and on video TV channels, that had any kind of positive uplifting message for humanity in the last 20 years. Let's take it back to the year 2000. So, you know, in previous decades, 90s, 80s, 70s, 60s, I could cite hundreds of examples of songs that delivered a powerful, strong message, and you could really get inside the lyrical content. But in the last 20 years, what has there been? That's not to say this music doesn't get made. And I have a show called The Sound of Freedom, which is a conscious music podcast that consists of just that type of music, meaningful message music from switched on, awakened artists. And I really enjoy collating all of that. But I have to dig deep for these records. I have to know where to look for them because they're not readily available to anyone looking at mainstream outlets. So the music is still being made, but obviously it's being kept from the general public getting to hear it on radio and such. And that's a very sad state of affairs.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you create this kind of desert out there, then it also provides the opportunities. It's a bit like the sort of economic situation. It, and, you know, the joblessness, particularly for young people, is it creates an opportunity like they had in the 1930s for some kind of Hitler-like figure to appear on the scene politically. Suddenly then the music, you know, the brakes on the music are released, then the brakes on the economy are released, and everyone feels like, wow, this is a great leader. So I'm a little bit concerned that, you know, this could be a kind of red carpet for fascism in the background here. But look, anyway, Mark, it's been fascinating hearing from you. Can you just wind up with just to let us know whereabouts we can get the book, what the book is called, etc., and also your music podcast, because I think we could all do with a listen to that.
Well, yeah, I think people are so COVIDed out in these times that they could certainly use some escapism. And from time to time, I get bogged down with all the heavy information and I just have to dive into some uplifting music to help me make it through the day. So the two books are called Musical Truth Volumes 1 and 2. They're both available on Amazon. I've also just written a novel, a symbolic allegorical novel, which I put out this year called The Cause and the Cure. That's also on Amazon. But if anyone wants to get those books directly from me, they can drop me an email to markdevlinuk@gmail.com and I can send out the signed copies. So the Sound of Freedom podcast is on my Spreaker and my Mixcloud pages. So if you just type in my name to either of those, you should find that. I'm just restarting another show called The Sound of Now, which I used to put out on an FM radio station based in Oxford. But I've been off that station since July. Was it something I said? And so now I'm putting these shows out again on my Spreaker and Mixcloud platforms. And these consist of positive, uplifting, soulful house music, which is a genre that really speaks to me and really helps me through these difficult times. I hope that has an effect on other people in a similar way. And really, for most of this year, I've put the music research on hold because with all this coronavirus nonsense and all this stuff jumping off, I've really felt the responsibility to put all my efforts and all my time and energy into exposing this massive scam. So pretty much all the videos I've put out this year have been on that subject. Very soon, I do want to get back to writing Musical Truth Volume 3. Because I've got a whole load of things I still need to say and put out there. But my YouTube channel is called Mark Devlin TV, and I put a new video out every weekend, just giving my thoughts and reflections on where we're at with this whole mess. And I try to deliver an uplifting message each week as well. I don't always find myself in that frame of mind, but if there's positivity to be found, I convey that to people, because there's enough doom and gloom mongers out there telling us we're all screwed and there's nothing but dread and terror in the future. Well, I don't want to add to their number.
No, definitely not. Actually, I think in a way, you know, there is definitely the light at the end of the tunnel is coming closer as the New World Order start to make blunders. I mean, I think that's what that's going on at the moment, and they're overstretching themselves. So also, what about the actual COVID tunes? Because I've come across one or two, Mark. Is there anything you could recommend, specific songs that have been made in the COVID era to express people's rather cynical attitude towards some of these silly rules like mask wearing and that sort of thing?
Well, I would direct people to Media Bear on YouTube. If you go to the Media Bear channel, they do spoof songs which are devastating satire of this whole thing. So they did a cover of Men Without Hats, The Safety Dance, and they called it The Safety Mask. And they've got lyrics like, you know, wear a mask if you want to, or you can leave the mask behind. And they're just mocking the whole idea of mask wearing and how stupid the whole thing is. They did a cover version of I Wear My Sunglasses at Night, which they called I Wear My Face Mask in the Car. And that's got lyrics like, I wear my face mask in the park so I can placate all the Karens in the park and so I can virtue signal in my neighborhood. So the guys putting these videos together, they understand what's happening. You know, they know the score and they're just putting it into this absolutely stinging satire. And what's the other one they've got? Oh, they did a cover of Queen, We Will Rock You, but they called it We Will Mock You. And so they're having a go at these Karens that are spreading their fear all over the place. They have a go at Joe Biden. They go in on mask wearers, you know. So Media Bear on YouTube, that's great. And then if you want some really hard-hitting conscious hip-hop, there's a dude called Diesel Automatic, and that's spelled D-I-S-L Automatic. Look him up on YouTube. He's done a few tunes about COVID, and he pulls no punches.
Mark Devlin, hope you don't get demonetized. You haven't been demonetized yet by YouTube, have you?
Well, funny you should say that. I had my first strike just today. They've warned me that two more strikes and I'm off, so it's probably going to happen. I've been preparing myself for this for some time. I've got all my videos on BitChute, so if it happens, it happens. It's happened to everyone else, so why wouldn't it happen to me?
Yep, and also, of course, you can't be allowed to actually make a success of cheering people up in this crazy new world. Mark Devlin, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, thanks a lot, man. Cheers.
Yep, and also, of course, you can't be allowed to actually make a success of cheering people up in this crazy new world. Mark Devlin, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, thanks a lot, man. Cheers.
So, that's Mark Devlin. Now, he was on Galaxy FM, if anyone remembers that, back in the 1990s and early noughties here in Bristol. And he used to do their, you know, he was one of their top DJs, Martin. You know, he used to do the Friday night and Saturday night. Also, like us, booted off the airwaves. I imagine he says, what was it something that I said? And this whole business of music. Now, it's like the Pied Piper, isn't it? The idea really here is the music industry can't be controlled. It's all about who the producers are and who, where the money's coming from for that industry.
Well,
you can turn the tap off, can't you?
Well, the music industry, like all other industries, is controlled by the powerful. We've just been talking about that all evening. And the music industry, as you well know, there's some kind of struggle goes in. I'm of an age to remember the punk revolution. And what happened during that era, for example, is we stopped listening to mainstream stuff that was from the United States of America and, you know, super stadiums with £50 a ticket. And a lot of the people who were making the music were our mates. And we made our own records and sold them hand to hand. And of course, what really made that possible was the John Peel show on Radio 1. And it was only 2 hours a day, but we never missed it. I'm sure you remember the era. And of course, that changed completely the music industry in Britain. But of course, it didn't change the music industry in the US in the same kind of way. And of course, what tends to happen it's what the situation is in the 1960s called recuperation. People start doing something different, challenging the status quo, and at first there's a little bit of a pushback against it, like the Rolling Stones, you can't hear them, Sex Pistols, you can't hear them, and then eventually they become mainstream, and eventually what started off as a kind of a cry of rebellion becomes basically a controlled message, which basically puts people back to sleep. And on that front, for example, can you think of any famous song by Pussy Riot?
No, but I keep hearing about them on the news.
No, indeed. They're a very, very famous Russian band who hate Putin, but they haven't got a single song that anybody can hum. Unlike God Save the Queen, which, of course, it's modelled on the punk revolution, yeah? But in actual fact, it ain't the punk revolution, and they're quite likely being funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, etc. And all over the world, we know Canvas, which was set up by people from Serbia who overthrew the regime in Serbia, they then were paid by the CIA and MI6 to work on color revolutions all over the world. And basically, young people are getting into, you know, social media and being fed a line on their own government, like in Belarus, for example. And of course, what's happened is that the CIA are basically, and the MI6, are basically in the business of running 1968s against governments they dislike. And many of the people participating in these movements in Hong Kong, for example, presume that or feel that they are rebelling against something, but in actual fact, the whole thing is being orchestrated from outside the country by wealthy people and the intelligence services that they operate. So, like always, you've got to be careful what's going on. What's the Clash said? You think it's funny turning rebellion into money. That's what they do.
That's what the
music industry is all about.
And it's a marketing rebellion. There's a money and marketing rebellion and revolution. And, of course, it will not be televised, will it? David Livingston Let's listen to him now before we're going to finish off with a couple of clips from James Perloff. But David Livingstone, it'd be really interesting to see what you make of this, Martin. Here he is in part of this talk, Order Ab Chaos, which means order from chaos, which is a little bit like Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, the idea that you can create chaos and then make money out of it and you control the outcomes. But where is Naomi coming from on that?
Well, I mean, her book, Disaster Capitalism, was extremely good in many ways. She researched it, but she was initially looking at what had happened in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. And she went there to do a sort of reportage. And it turned out that all of the artisanal fishing communities along the coast of Sri Lanka, they were wiped out by the tsunami. But instead of allowing these people to come back and rebuild their lives, they just whacked a load of luxury hotels right up against the beach. So she started looking at that. She then started looking at the ways in
which... So the shock doctrine was the tsunami. The shock was the tsunami.
Yeah, but she started with a particular thing, but then she realized that this was a general phenomenon. And that the shock doctrine, I mean, you've got to read the book to realise how well researched it is. What's missing from the book is fundamental, from my point of view, is that 9/11 was an inside job. That is the shock doctrine. She would probably recognise that the invasion of it. There's a whole chapter on the invasion of Iraq and what happened with that and after the aftermath. But of course, she won't go there, and probably for good reason, and say, in actual fact, 9/11 was an inside job. And I'd like to say to all these doctors that are going on about fascism, speak up about 9/11. 3,000 people were killed.
That's not their expertise, Martin. That's your expertise.
Well, indeed. Well, I'm dragging them back to military intelligence analysis.
Well, they don't know a lot about military intelligence, doctors. No, but they do know about whether people are dying or not and how to treat them.
Well, indeed. But some doctors
and when that might go great against the Gates Foundation.
Yes. Well, I'm no friend of the Gates Foundation, but. You know, people have got their views.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen to David Livingstone. And here he talks about the Royal Society and how things moved on from there over the years. So, I mean, I just find his analysis absolutely fascinating. He's basically saying, maybe before we hear from him, Martin, you can hear what, I mean, I'll tell you in a nutshell what he's saying, is that the Royal Society created this whole idea of that God was a silly thing to believe in through science, that science was going to replace God. And then there was a kind of spiritual movement that came along, led by the theosophists, to say, well, actually, there is a spiritual, and just almost replace God with a new kind of spirituality. What do you make of that? Is that stretching a point?
Well, I mean, the intellectual history of the Western world is quite a complicated thing. I mean, Voltaire was one of the first to start asking questions about the existence of God or non-existence of God. And, you know...
Surely people have been asking that question.
No.
Right, the Greeks, the Romans, come on.
Well, the Greeks certainly did ask the questions. The philosophers in Greece basically did start to ask the questions about maybe there are no gods at all, which is why the modern idea of humanism and atheism comes from. But don't forget, in the 17th century, when the Civil War was raging in this country, nobody on any side didn't believe in God, because that's what people believed at the time.
You could say that, but then some of these people were pseudo-God believers, weren't they? They were using the whole idea of faith for the political ends.
Well, what you've got is, what actually happens is, my God's better than your God. So, you know, everybody believed in God, but the God you believe in isn't the right one, that's why I've got the right to kill you.
I mean, this is like the whole argument around Northern Ireland being about, you know, Catholics versus Protestants. It wasn't. I mean, to a certain extent, it was one community, which was a dominant community, using faith as an excuse on, and it was badly reported as well, that actually it's one group against another, one that happens to be mostly Catholic against one that happens to be mostly Protestant. This has been a divide and rule tactic for centuries, surely.
Yeah, but centuries, the modern Northern Ireland, I totally agree with you, but don't forget, there was the Battle of the Boyne, there was the penal laws. And in actual fact, it goes back into history. The Protestant ascendancy were put in power in Ireland to keep the Irish down for English benefit.
And I would say
that's what went on for years.
I would say that most of the Puritans didn't have a Christian bone in their body, personally.
Well, and then the Catholics would agree with you, but then on the other hand, they would then, you know, there were massacres on both sides.
Okay, let's have a listen anyway to David Livingstone talking about the developments that came about with the creation of the Royal Society.
The thing is occultism is pseudoscience, right? Mm-hmm. Magic is a kind of, magic is a, it's, it's a pseudoscience, but it deals, I mean, magic, like the hadith says, magic is real. Right? So magic is not some, you know, you don't just tap a wand and poof, something happens. There is a science behind it. But it's a kind of science that modern science has yet to identify. Basically, I would compare it to how people would have perceived electricity 500 years ago, right? So what occultists are trying to do, is, especially alchemists, that they're trying to advance their knowledge of the occult phenomena of nature and the universe. So that's why, especially in Western history, most of the famous scientists have all been occultists. And Newton, prime example. It's not an accident that he's deeply interested in occultism. It feeds his interest in science.
Mm.
So this is why the Royal Society basically developed the focus on science, but it's not atheistic. It's occultist. So it's anti-God, not atheistic.
Mm. Got it.
So, I mean, that's where you get Darwinism. Darwinism basically comes from the Royal Society, that basically promoted Darwin, and they're the ones who created the sort of, you know, empiricist, atheistic understanding. I mean, even the Enlightenment was based on the same idea, but the Enlightenment was occultic. It was Luciferian. It wasn't fully atheistic. It denounced the belief in the supernatural, but all the participants were themselves occultists who were deeply fascinated by the supernatural.
Mm. Mm.
So the Royal Society creates the Freemasons, and so now let's jump ahead. So the most important, at the time of the Illuminati, there's numerous cults that were important. One of the most important ones, so Illuminati, of course, got exposed in 1787. They were disbanded. And supposedly that was the end of that. So what's important was that there was another cult that called Martinism, another secret society called Martinism. So Martinism survived, and it became Synarchism. And how Synarchism becomes important is that, so this is where it gets important to follow. So at the end of, you know, speaking of the importance of science, religion had been discredited, and empirical science had taken its place. So in this vacuum comes the occult revival. So the occult revival basically says this, that science has gone too far. They've dismissed the existence of the supernatural. There's something's out there. Let's explore it. So that's what the occult revival did. So the leading personality occult revival was Elena Blavatsky. Hmm. She's basically considered the godmother of the occult. So Blavatsky was in contact with a number of what she called ascended masters. And these were basically jinn that impersonated, departed dependent masters. But one of her masters, she claimed to be in contact with what she called the Brotherhood of Luxor. So Luxor in Egypt. And so one scholar, his name is K. Paul Johnson, he has pointed out that one of Blavatsky's ascended masters was Jamaluddin Al-Afghani, the founder of Salafism.
So these ascended masters, what he's saying there, Martin, is the Theosophists were very closely connected with setting up Salafism, which now, of course, has led to these movements in Islam, what he's described as occult movements in Islam, which have led to the terrorists of today, the Salafists, for example.
Well, what he's doing is he's joining a lot of dots together to explain everything in one simple explanation. And
I wouldn't say simple, it's a bit complicated.
Well, it's complicated, but it's one explanation for everything. And I read extensively in intellectual history, and I have done for many years, and in actual fact, you've got lots of different views, surprisingly enough. Just as we have on this show in the evenings, in the past, people had lots of different views. There wasn't just one. I think he's quite right to point out that many of the Enlightenment thinkers were in fact influenced by occult ideas. Newton wrote far more about the Kabbalah, because Keynes bought his papers in the 1930s, and everybody was fascinated to find that Newton spent more of his time on what we might nowadays call occult matters, astrology and the Kabbalah, and that was more important to him than the discovery of gravity. But there you go. And the gravity stuff has stood the test of time, the rest of it less so.
Okay, well, we'll finish up this week with James Perloff, who was on the Richie Allen show a couple of days ago. I think it was a Tuesday version, where he talks about this whole thing that's going on right now as an evil Luciferian agenda. And within that, he's saying, then maybe before we hear that, Martin, we can hear from you. He's saying basically that there may well be another kind of pandemic very soon, because as the pandemic number one runs out of steam, there may be a deliberate release of another genetically modified virus, or even maybe something which has been stored up for years, something nasty, to be released in order to kind of keep the kettle boiling, so to speak.
Well, it's quite possible we may have a nuclear exchange. If you look what's being said in India and Pakistan, not that we follow these things too much in this country, politicians on both sides are threatening to nuke each other. They do it quite frequently.
We're very grateful to Richie Allen, because he's now putting our show on a Sunday at noon. You can hear this show on the Richie Allen channel. But anyway, that's not why I'm playing this. I'm playing it because it's fascinating. Good to hear that James Perloff was on our show last Friday, and Richie this week too. And his book is COVID-19 Red Pilled.
I know you've got a deep and personal faith, and I respect it. I'm pretty much agnostic. I don't know, but I have great respect for men and women of faith. Mostly the people I know, they're usually the best people I know, and I shouldn't really say that now, but they generally are the most conscientious anyway. I think you believe it, don't you? I'm not expressing skepticism here now, I'm just putting it out there, that it is connected, that this has been foretold in the Bible, and here we are. And if people accept this, that this is some sort of satanic agenda.
As Luciferian, Luciferian. Very impressed when Ronald Bernard, the Dutch former Dutch currency manipulator, went on to YouTube with viral videos exposing the whole European money system, and saying that he was asked as a top banker, eventually he was asked to actually take part in child ritual sacrifice. This was satanic. He was taken to the Church of Satan. And this is a top banker. And this has been exposed for a long time. You know, you go back to Ted Gunderson, the former FBI chief in Los Angeles. Yeah. You go back to the 1950s. William Guy Carr of Canadian Intelligence said these people were Luciferians. It's true. You know, even if other people don't accept the idea of Lucifer, these people do. And they're not, you know, when I was a hippie, which is, you know, we're talking the early 1970s, we're talking, oh man, 50 years ago. When I was a hippie, that was a sort of a Marxist viewpoint that the only thing that motivated these rich people at the top was money. But, you know, money is the carrot that they use to motivate people. In reality, there's an evil there that goes beyond money. You know, there's no money in poisoning people with chemtrails. There's no money in wiping out populations, reducing population. There's no money in that for them. This is about more than money. It's about a very evil agenda.
Okay, a very evil agenda. Martin, do you think that's possibly true? I mean, I'm not asking you to answer the questions about the Luciferian side of things, but the idea that actually it's not about money, it's money is a kind of means to an end, to power?
Power, it's about power. And money is a means to power. There's various things going on, but power is at the root of it.
So we're talking about really a kind of almost like an obsession with power, almost like it's a drug, I suppose it might be.
Well, yeah, you've got your psychopaths and your sociopaths, and they tend to be the people that run political movements and so on, because basically, if you haven't got some psychopaths and sociopaths, your enemies will have. So what, through a process of competition, what tends to happen is that the ones that shouldn't be run, people that shouldn't be running things are the ones who end up running things, because people with a more balanced and kind of sane point of view don't want to be doing those sort of things, so they end up not doing it. But of course, as Aristotle pointed out years ago, if you're not prepared to get involved in politics, because you're too, you know, you're too, you know, you're, it's too beneath you, then other people who have got less scruples will tell you what to do.
One of the things James Perloff does say is, and in fact he's quite good on this whole thing about light at the end of the tunnel, because it can be a bit doomy and gloomy. He said, well, if you start looking at Revelation, you realise that the end is not about the devil, it's actually about Christ, Martin.
Yeah, well, this is where I part company. I don't believe in prophecy.
Do you believe in there being light at the end of the tunnel here? Is it a winnable war?
I don't believe in prophecy, and I think there is a possibility. It's like a mining disaster. We're in a mining disaster, and if we organise ourselves sufficiently, we might escape. But of course, the odds are that we're not going to. There's been two world wars because of the evil of the way in which we organise things, and it's quite likely there's going to be a third. Now, if it's a nuclear war, we're all dead. If it's not a nuclear war, we've just got to make sure that the bad guys lose it. And there's going to be a huge sacrifice demanded from everybody. And it's not going to be, it's not going to be a tea party or a knitting circle.
I don't think even the Book of Revelation says it's going to be a tea party. But it does say that ultimately good will win over evil.
Well, that's just an aspiration, isn't it?
Is it a possible one?
It's possible. But it's not necessary. I mean, basically, I don't believe that anybody out there is going to say, we've got to save ourselves. And if we mess this planet on, which is a tiny speck of dust in the middle of nowhere, if we mess it up, there's going to be no second chances. And of course, we are very much at a inflection point, since 1945. This is it. But it's more likely that we're going to have a nuclear war than climate change is going to kill us. And the things that we used to care about in the 60s and 70s, the possibility that the world was going to be destroyed through military means, is by far the most dangerous thing we face.
Everything to fight for and everything to play for. I think at least we can agree on that, Martin.
Yes. And why do we bother? Because what's the choice? There isn't one.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, that is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and also the contact details of Bristol Community FM. You can write them a nice polite letter if you like, asking them to put the show back on and get rid of the people reading out Reuters press releases and not doing an analysis. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday noon, we're rebroadcast on the Richie Allen stream at richieallen.co.uk. Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM, the glorious tunes from Danny Lopsch. Do please join us on the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. It's a little bit like After Dark. Do you remember that programme, Martin, on Channel 4? It kind of goes on, luckily, not till 1 o'clock in the morning. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
are we living in a land where sex and horror